go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Hey, it's Thursday here, but it feels like Tuesday to me because all my rhythms are still sort of just squirrely from the trip. But I'll get back to normal somehow or another. This is the Thursday evening edition of Head On. Welcome aboard. And in the where to start all this department this evening, I know Mark didn't mention it, and since I can't, don't have time to listen to a bunch of other liberal talk, I don't know who has or hasn't today, but it would be a crime. Now, I know there are other crimes going on, but it would be a crime not to note this at the beginning of the program, at least within the scope of the way that I view the world. And that is this. This is the 19th day of March, 2009. I want to share some words with you. They are not recorded. It is a transcript. My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war. These are opening stages of what will be a broad and concerted campaign. More than 35 countries are given crucial support from the use of naval and air bases to help with intelligence and logistics to the deployment of combat units. Every nation in this coalition has chosen to bear the duty and share the honor of serving in our common defense. To all of the men and women of the United States Armed Forces now in the Middle East, the peace of a troubled world and the hopes of an oppressed people now depend on you. That trust is well placed. The enemies you confront will come to know your skill and bravery. The people you liberate will witness the honorable and decent spirit of the American military. In this conflict, America faces an enemy who has no regard for conventions of war or rules of morality. Saddam Hussein has placed Iraqi troops and equipment in civilian areas, attempting to use innocent men, women, and children as shields for his own military, a final atrocity against his people. I want Americans and all the world to know that coalition forces will make every effort to spare innocent civilians from harm. A campaign on the harsh terrain of a nation as large as California could be longer and more difficult than some predict. And helping Iraqis achieve a united, stable, and free country will require our sustained commitment. We come to Iraq with respect for its citizens, for their great civilization, and for the religious faiths they practice. We have no ambition in Iraq except to remove a threat and restore control of that country to its own people. I know that the families of our military are praying that all those who serve will return safely and soon. Millions of Americans are praying with you for the safety of your loved ones and for the protection of the innocent. For your sacrifice, you have the gratitude and respect of the American people, and you can know that our forces will be coming home as soon as their work is done. Our nation enters this conflict reluctantly, yet our purpose is sure. The people of the United States and our friends and allies will not live at the mercy of an outlaw regime that threatens the peace with weapons of mass murder. We will meet that threat now with our Army, Air Force, Navy, Coast Guard, and Marines, so that we do not have to meet it later with armies of firefighters and police and doctors on the streets of our cities. Now that conflict has come, the only way to limit its duration is to apply decisive force. And I assure you, this will not be a campaign of half measures, and we will accept no outcome but victory. My fellow citizens, the dangers to our country and the world will be overcome. We'll pass through this time of peril and carry on the work of peace. We will defend our freedom. We will bring freedom to others, and we will prevail. May God bless our country and those and all those who defend her. 6 years ago today. 6 years ago today. I'm almost struck dumb by the mendacity of those words. I'm almost rendered speechless by the cruel, cynical, perverse spirit in which they were offered. That is the address of George W. Bush, delivered at 0315 Greenwich Mean Time, Thursday, March the 19th, 2003. Those were the words that initiated waves of death and destruction whose ripples still wash bloody upon the shores of the whole world. When I read those words, they read to me like an indictment. Without the cutesy little phony faux Texas dialect, those words should be read in sober, somber tones by a world-class lawyer looking George W. Bush straight in the eye as Bush stands in the dock at The Hague. Lines like, I want Americans and all the world to know that coalition forces will make every effort to spare innocent civilians from harm, should go on that man's tombstone when he goes to his just reward. You know, in perfect harmony with the nature of what a beast that man is and was, do you know how he marked the 6th anniversary of the war he started? You know, this speech, if you will, claims that now that war has come, that phrase just makes my guts twist in knots. Now that war has come. Jesus. War didn't come. War was made. War didn't come. War was sent. War didn't come. War was chosen. To defend the world from grave danger, George W. Bush, you malevolent, filthy, bloody-handed, murderous liar. What grave danger? They knew. We know they knew. They know we know they knew. We know they know we knew they knew. That there was no danger. There was no threat. We know about the Downing Street memo. We know about all of it. We know about murder for hire. We know about rendition. We know about torture. We know about the confidential Red Cross torture report that came out detailing suffocation and the head smashing of detainees. It has quotes like this: I was taken out of my cell and one of the interrogators wrapped a towel around my neck. They then used it to swing me around and smash me repeatedly against the hard walls of the room. And both my feet became very swollen after 1 month of almost continual standing. And then a thick, flexible plastic collar would also be placed around my neck so that it can then be held at the two ends by a guard who would use it to slam me repeatedly against the wall. We know about it. And hence the line, in this conflict, America faces an enemy who has no regard for conventions of war or rules of morality, ring with an especially bitter hypocrisy. Six years. Over at the main website of CNN, the most trusted name in news, the following headlines. We do this from time to time. It's always nice to check in. Headline: House okays bill taxing bailed out firms' bonuses. Headline: blunt impact killed Richardson official says. Headline: Mexico cartels thrive in suburban South. Headline: 7.7 earthquake strikes off Tonga. Headline: Wall Street rally hits a roadblock. Then finally, Iraq, one of longest U.S. wars. What? That's it? Iraq, one of longest U.S. wars? Not Iraq? Nightmare stain on the American psyche, not Iraq. Pernicious blot on American history. How about really simple stuff? Iraq, war crime. Iraq, crime against humanity. Deadly spider captured at deli counter. No, I'm sorry, deadly spider captured in deli container. John Mayer tweets on Jennifer Aniston split. Tougher talk with family. Sex or money? Not that I expected anything much different. On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war. Against whom? When? Where? How? Why? Oh, wait. Who, what, when, where, why, how? What are the... Oh, my God! Those are journalism questions! Those are the questions that American for-profit media refused to ask. Take a red Sharpie or crayon or something, and on your wall calendar, if you still have one and don't just rely on your computer, fill in March the 19th. When this year becomes an old year and it's time to get the new calendar down to the bank, if they're still printing calendars by then, first thing you do when you get the new calendar, fill in March the 19th. Lord God, never let us forget this day. We need a, you know what? You remember how we were talking last night about how Lou Dobbs, isn't there just an American holiday? Because he didn't like St. Patrick's Day. Remember that? That tubby-ass fool on CNN that apparently has a radio station somewhere or radio show somewhere. I got an idea. Most religions in the world have something approaching a day, week, or month of atonement. Right? We need a national secular day of atonement. A day when the United States looks back and says to itself, oh my God, what the hell have we done? What were we thinking? How can we possibly make it right? Maybe that day should be March the 19th every year. We'll call it Bush Day. Because American Crimes Against Humanity Day is just too much of a mouthful and might not take off. We'll get away with it by telling Republicans that we're going to give George Bush a day and we're going to name it after him. It's going to be George Bush Day. And we will spend it in the secular equivalent of sackcloth and ashes. The people you liberate will witness the honorable and decent spirit of the American military. How's that working out? Not so much. Abu Ghraib. 15-year-old girl raped and left for dead. Weapons dropped by the corpses of men shot for sport. With the drop gun then used to try to cover up the fact that it was, as Shakespeare said, heady murder. We come to Iraq with respect for its citizens, for their great civilization, and for the religious faiths they practice. Got Google Earth? Go look at Babylon. Go have a look at Babylon. Lovingly restored over the decades, right down to the Ishtar Gate. If you check the archaeological reports, you'll find that that the ruins of Babylon have now been damaged beyond repair. We did that. Not Saddam. No, we did. We who had respect for their citizens, their great civilization, and the religious faiths they practice. A Marine painted Semper Fi, not Semper Fi, F-I, Semper Fi, F-E, on the walls of Nebuchadnezzar's palace. enrolling through Baghdad, we rushed to send forces to guard the oil ministry and left the Iraqi Museum of Antiquities unguarded, where ancient cuneiform tablets made of baked clay were hurled off shelves to the floor and became returned to the dust they once had been. We waged pitched battles over the bones of thousands upon thousands of Muslim dead in the most sacred cemeteries of Iraq. We come to Iraq with respect for its citizens, for their great civilization, and for the religious faiths they practice. We have blown up their mosques. We have shot their imams. We have raped their women. And we have slaughtered their children. In the most conservative of estimates, 1,000 Iraqis who were not part of the conflict, 100,000 Iraqis who were not part of the conflict, are dead. Millions of Americans are praying with you for the safety of your loved ones and for the protection of the innocent. Looks like God was on vacation again, doesn't it? Those 100,000 conservatively estimated innocents, and more rationally and more reasonably and far more likely, those millions, that million innocents, that 1/6 of a Holocaust, dead under rubble, shot in the streets, blown apart at the markets, rendered dead by missile strikes in the midst of what little festivity they could muster at the wedding of a loved one. Dead, dead, dead. Our nation enters this conflict reluctantly. Bull, you dirty, rotten liar. We will not live at the mercy of an outlaw regime. And yet, for 5 long years after the utterance of those words, we in this country continued to live at the mercy of an outlaw regime. We will not live at the mercy of an outlaw regime that threatens the peace with weapons of mass murder. And yet, even after the Democrats in Congress took power, Nancy Pelosi continued to force us to live at the mercy of an outlaw regime that was not only threatening the peace, but breaking it with weapons of mass murder. I dare not speak for you, I speak only for myself. But on this, the 19th day of March 2009, I at least mark what Franklin Roosevelt once called a day that will live in infamy. Let no one forget. Let mothers tell their daughters. Let fathers tell their sons. That great and powerful nations may turn away from the path of righteousness and may do manifestly evil things
when the people abdicate their power. That is this day. That is our great sin, to use those terms. March the 19th, if viewed at some, in some long lens by some long-distant future historian, an Edward Gibbon in a spacesuit, perhaps. March the 19th, 2003, may be the date chosen. For a tome titled, The Rise and Fall of the American Empire. The date chosen to mark the beginning of the end. You want to talk about AIG bonuses? We're having to talk about AIG bonuses because of what began on March the 19th, 2003. Everything that has flowed afterward goes home to a filthy buzzard's roost on March the 19th, 2003. Because, you see, the economy had to be dummied up, faked up, phonied up, rubed up, and ginned up to hide the fact that we were spending ourselves into perdition on this filthy criminal war that George Bush elected to wage for reasons that to this day defy reason. I started earlier, but then I didn't finish. Do you know how George Bush marked this day? George Bush marked this day in, I believe, Duval County, Florida. Jacksonville. George Bush marked this day that will live in infamy by going out and hustling for money. He went to a private luncheon. Where he was hustling money for his stupid little library at SMU. On the day that marked the downfall of so much that so many had pinned their hopes on, namely a peaceful future, a dignified retirement, a complete and intact family, loved ones not shattered in their sleep by post-traumatic stress disorder, sons, daughters, brothers, sisters, fathers, mothers, aunts, uncles, cousins, not getting the sweats at the sight of a person with darker skin or perhaps a cabbie in traffic. All those hopes dashed, and George Bush, with nary a care in the world, went out and prostituted himself for money today. Damn him. And I mean that in every pure biblical sense of the word. Damn him. It doesn't really matter since he isn't there, but may God damn him. May he look in the mirror and see horrifying hallucinatory glimpses of the faces of the children and the mothers and the sons and the daughters and the fathers whose blood he shed on the sands of Iraq. May he live not a moment in peace. May he hear the screams of the anguished dead when he tries to close his eyes to sleep. What George Bush did on March the 19th, 2003 is the stuff that the kinds of retribution envisioned by the ancient Greeks. Would be more than suitable for. Shunned by all decent human beings, left to wander the world an accursed man for the rest of his days. Damn, you know, Oedipus didn't even mean to be banging on his mama. And he had to gouge his own eyes out and be cast out of the city gates to wander homeless, shamed and alone for the rest of his days. And he didn't even mean to. George Bush meant to. And for so long as the American people refuse to demand justice for George Bush, his bloody stain will be our bloody stain. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Juanita.
Hey, Juanita.
I'd like to say some things, what I remember about the start of that, of the conflict.
Go right ahead.
And, but before that, he said, Bush said something when he was running for president that made me know that he wanted to go to war with Saddam Hussein. And I can't really tell you what it was, but at the time, you know, it just, I just thought, that's what he wants to do. And things that he would say after he became president. This is before 9/11. And anyway, when, you know, the talk was about us going over to Iraq and all, a lot of people I knew said, oh, he wants to do everything, keep us out of war over there. And I said, no, he doesn't. I said, he wants to go over there so bad that he can taste it. And I really believe that. And then another thing is that saying that he lied to get us into Iraq, what could we expect when his daddy did the same thing?
Indeed.
Why should we? Huh?
Indeed.
Yeah. And another thing I wanted to say about it was that I had never heard Mike Malloy before. He was on another radio station before he came to Air America,
mm-hmm.
and then he wasn't on there for a while. And the time that he was on, I heard him. Well, of all things, I don't remember the exact date, but you say that today is the anniversary?
Yes.
He said he told on that show, first time I ever heard the man, he told on that show about us that it had started, and he was just grieving over it. I never will forget that.
I remember it as well.
And he was grieving over it. But anyway, that's what I wanted to say. The man, that was his heart's desire, I believe. That he wanted that ever president.
Oh, he yearned for it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, more than a year before he started it, a Newsweek reporter, I forget who it was, poked his head in or was allowed access to some sort of cabinet conference or something, and someone said, what about Iraq? Or what about Saddam?
and George Bush piped up and said, F Saddam, we're going to take him out.
Well, I heard something similar to that at the time, too. I don't know if it's the same.
You know, Juanita, I can't hardly put words to it. When I think about how he sat there and he lied to the people of the United States about how war was not my first choice. War, all of that stuff. And the fact that the American people tolerated it, and we never demanded that he be confronted with that lie that he took. How many times, Juanita, Lord God, how many times did we sit and we watch in this endless loop of Bill Clinton saying, I did not have sex with that woman, Miss Lewinsky.
Oh, sure.
I did not have sex with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. Mm-hmm. I did not have sex with that woman, Miss Lewinsky, over and over and over and over.
And it was 24 hours a day. That was when I watched, the Fox and all that I watched. And, you know, it was just, I remember when Oberman, you know, was on, I don't know if he was on Fox or one of the others. And he, you know, had left the sports to be get into that, and he ran right into the thing about Clinton, and he was just sick of it. He said he said I can't take anymore, and you know he went back to sports for a while. But he was the only one. I mean, it was every day. And oh, it's not what he did; it's that he lied. He lied.
It's about the rule. It's the rule of law. It's the rule.
And
right? Yeah.
And you remember when they went to the Supreme Court because he said that it would stand in the way of him governing? And the Supreme Court said, oh, no.
Well, see, I had a – yeah, Juanita, while I was in D.C. over near where we were gathering our sort of headquarters for our operation earlier this week, was near the Supreme Court building. And we were walking by it one afternoon, and I stopped the girls. And I said, girls, read me what it says on the lintel there above the columns. And Doodle looked up and she said, equal justice under law, Daddy. I said, that's right. Now, bear in mind, girls, that there are five men who sit on that court who don't even believe in that.
Yeah.
Five out of nine.
Sure.
That's a majority. You know, when I think about things like the Lilly Ledbetter case, she didn't get equal justice under law. She got the full measure of unequal injustice under law.
Right.
From thugs like Alito and Scalia and Roberts and Thomas and Kennedy.
Yeah.
How will, Juanita, I ask you, and you are a far better person than I am. How, Juanita, will America ever blot this stain off of our national being? Or will we wander around for another 100, 200 years with stains like, I mean, you know, the stain of Vietnam is still upon us.
Yeah.
How will we ever get it off? Will we wander around like Lady Macbeth
people.
Saying, out, out, damned spot?
Right. These are the same people that brought us Iran gate and all like that, you know, and the stuff in Central America, and God only knows what we don't know about.
How many thousands upon thousands died at the whim of Ronald Reagan in El Salvador and Nicaragua and Guatemala and Honduras and Panama?
Yeah. And I don't know if I should say this or not, but, and I don't know if I'm going to say exactly, but, you know, you still have to be careful, but, the South America, you know, all that killing and all slaughter down there, you know, Monty, what's his name? Montenegro? Is that his name?
Who are you talking about?
The one that it was supposed to be for the slaughter down there in San Salvador.
Oh, I can't come up with the name right
now.
Do
you know who I'm talking about?
Yeah,
today?
I do.
Yeah. It's something like, it's not. That's a capital of a country, but it's something like that. But anyway, when they start, remember when they had those slaughterings in Iraq, and they said it was, I don't know if they would thought it was the Taliban or whatever, you know, and they'd find all these bodies where the bodies had been mutilated and obviously were tortured. Do you remember that one of the people that saw some of that going on, they said the people that were doing that had the most modern equipment, vehicle, and everything. And they heard them, one of them, speak in English. Now, that's all I'm going to say. I mean, if you, he who has ears to hear, let him hear.
There you go. There you go.
And now it's come out about Cheney.
Murder Incorporated.
Murder Incorporated. I mean, it don't surprise me, but yet still, see what it really.
Oh, Negroponte, Negroponte.
Yeah, it hurts me, Bob. It hurts me that we won't prosecute or even investigate these people. It hurts, and I'm with other people because. Why should anybody obey the law?
Well, look, Juanita, I'll take it a step further. If you buy into this business of a judgment day, you know, the Lamb's Book of Life and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And everything's being written down.
Oh, yeah.
How do you not, how does any American go to their judgment without this stain upon them? How?
Because they're believing a lie.
No. What I'm saying, you and I, you know, taxpayers, all we did was, you know, pay our taxes, but the paying of the taxes paid for this.
Yeah. We did.
What do you do when St. Juanita, what do you do when St. Peter looks down at you and says, I see you had a part in slaughtering a million innocents. How do you respond?
Yeah, I think. Bob, I really believe it is still being watched that I think, now this is my opinion, and this is just like a peripheral, or not, what do you call it, ephemeral thing, but I feel like that God has given us a second chance, and if we blow it this time, it's going to be too late, baby.
I think there's every reason in the world to think it's already too late.
Well, but you know, the thing about the person in charge, Obama, he's not perfect. I'm not looking to him for a savior, you know, they want to say. But they did, Bush. He was looked on as a savior. He was, could do no wrong. Nothing that he did was wrong, no matter what. And you saw the people in the, James Robinson, he was just fawning over him. You know, he came on his show and he's running for president. Oh, this wonderful man of God, you know. I mean, please. And I think that God is disgusted. And I don't understand everything, believe me. And you say that I'm a better person than you. Bob, the only thing that's good about me is what I allow Jesus to be in me. That's the way I feel, because I wasn't always this perfect person.
Yeah, but I think...
Now, I know I'm going, stepping over the line talking about what I believe, but I can believe it. It don't matter what...
Oh, no, you're not stepping over any line, Juanita.
And I stand to be, you know, changed, you know, too. I changed from what I fell for that when I was so confused. I fell for that line that they... brought up, and I still think I was hypnotized or something, or brainwashed or something, but I'm sure thankful I got out of it.
Well, you know, I was having a Facebook chat earlier today as I was doing my prep work, and we were, the individual I was chatting with was talking about the fact that, you know, how conservatives behave so cruelly and loathsomely and just downright butt ugly rotten.
Yeah.
As a group. And yet these same people, you know, they'll be decent to a soul if they're acting individually, but they get into their collectivism
yeah.
and they turn into monsters.
I found just like Amway. Oh my God, Juanita. But I find a great deal of irony in that, because these are the ones who scream socialism at the mention of everybody being able to go to the doctor when they're sick.
Yeah.
These are the people who hang fast to those freakish books by Ayn Rand that criticizes collectivism and it's going to be the individual, the rugged individual. But the fact of the matter is, the rugged individual disappears in the conservative mindset, because the only thing they know how to do is answer to authority. They're the collectivists.
They want everybody to think alike.
Yeah, they're the collectivists, not us.
Yeah. But and I think, you know, they don't want sex education in the schools. Well, some kids, that's all sex education they'll get. And if they don't get it from the teacher, they're going to get it on the ground, and it's going to be wrong. And it could be wrong from the teacher, too. You don't know. But nothing in this life is perfect.
There you go.
But I don't know what they want. I told Charles, I said, head on Alex Jones. And I believe a lot of what he says. But I said, what kind of government does the man want? You know, now it's all about...
I got to tell you, where Alex Jones is concerned, Juanita, I mean, you and I are just going to have to agree to disagree. That man's a hustler, okay? He's not a televangelist, but he's got the spirit of one. This video that he's got coming out about how he's going to reveal the deep, dark, dirty secret of Barack Obama?
Oh, he's already out.
Oh, God. Yeah, it is already out.
It's on YouTube, free.
Oh, please. You know, ouch. Hey, Juanita, you have managed to light up all the lines, so I'm going to try to get through some more calls, okay?
Okay.
Take care now.
All right, good night.
Bye now. From Central Florida, that's our buddy Juanita. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello, Bob.
Hey, Bob.
How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm in my remembering state. I'm remembering days when somebody said, our ships have been attacked on the high seas. And it was a lie.
Sure.
And we must respond. And we bombed a country then, did we not?
Oh, what, million? 2 million civilians dead?
2 million, Bob. 2 million. Yeah?
Yeah.
And now, and not sitting in the same day, the same day. It is absolutely the same day. Shock and awe. Remember that?
I do remember, Bob, and I was trying desperately not to use that phrase, because it damn nigh brings up dinner just to think about it.
Yeah. And now here we stand on this day. But I want you, my good friend, my dear friend, to remember there were millions, nay, tens, no, hundreds of millions of people across this planet that screamed as I did, no, 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 don't go. We screamed it, Bob, at the top of our lungs. But who listened? Did the mainstream media listen? No, they broadcast shock and awe. Bombs falling on Iraq, Baghdad in flames, dying women and children, dying fathers and mothers, dying brothers and sisters of a country that had never attacked this nation. Not this nation. They may have attacked, thing down there at the end of their country. They called it what? Kuwait?
Yeah.
Oh, they tried to take back one of their provinces that had been stolen from them after World War One? Or maybe it was never an Iraq before World War One. It was the Ottoman Empire. See, people forget their history, and then they're doomed to repeat it. You people, the people of the United States, you forgot your history, the history that you sent me into hell for. And now you've sent other sons and daughters into hell for your forgotten history. It's time to wake up, to realize we've done this over and over and over. Thank you, Bob. Bob Kincaid, thank you for bringing it to light. And your narration at the beginning of this program was just that, bringing it to light. And I thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
But you've got a long show, and you've got a lot of people to talk to, and they've probably got a lot better things to say than I do. So, from North Dakota to the ends, and maybe to the ends of the earth, and maybe to God's ear, let's bring them home, shut it down, quit this evil empire thing, and become something other than Dick Cheney's and Negro Pontes and that little squatting pimp that used to be in the White House, George Bush. Let's stop it. And if we have to fall as an empire, let us fall humbly and beg, beg the rest of the world to forgive us. And promise, like Germany did after World War II, that they would never, ever do it again. And they've done a pretty good job so far.
They have done a pretty good job so far.
Huh?
They have done a pretty good job so far, but they had to lose a war to do it.
Right. And we.
It had to be imposed upon them.
And we need to have it imposed upon us. We can't impose it upon ourselves. We need to quit thinking like we own this planet. We do not. We are just caretakers of it. And if we cannot take care of it, then we have no business being here. And as a nation. And that's what I have to say on the George Bush Remember Day. A day that will live in infamy. That's my truth to the Head On Radio Network. I love you folks so much. I missed you, but I had to call in today because it's a day to say what we have done and what we are guilty of. And you did a good job, Bob. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. We'll talk soon, I hope.
Get it on.
Be well.
Done. And stand. Just stand and say no more. No mas. We will not stand for it. Good night.
Good night, Bob. Take care.
Good luck.
Thanks.
America. And, of course, you too. And Agnes, our love. And to the boy, I hope he's doing much better.
He's feeling a lot better, Bob. Thank you for your kind thoughts.
Keep him under wraps until he's good to go.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a chore, Bob, but we're trying.
Wouldn't doubt it. Hey, love you much.
Take care, brother. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
From the high plains of North Dakota, it's Bob. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hey, Susan.
Your curse,
mm-hmm.
Your damning of... You just cursed him to everything that gibbering monster loves.
Well, I don't believe in those sort of things anyway, but it doesn't hurt. But you mean the blood and the death and the gore and the... Yeah, I know.
Oh, yeah. If he... I'm firmly...
Well, I want it, but I want him... But see, I want him to have a surfeit of it. I want him to... Even, you know, when you go to work... Well, used to be when we had a Hershey plant in Hershey. When you went to work at Hershey, they'd tell you to eat all the chocolates you could stand. It was a chocolate lover's dream come true. And within a week, nobody ate chocolate anymore. I want, in some sort of afterlife or eternal realm or whatever, I want George Bush to be treated like a goose being prepared for pate, for foie gras, okay? I want his mouth forcibly jacked open, a funnel jammed down his throat, and I just want the blood of a million people poured down it forevermore.
Well, the never-ending chocolate idea works if you're a normal person. He's not normal by any stretch of the imagination. He wants more. No matter how much he gets, he has to have more. So he can never get enough. The best curse to lay on him? Utter and complete powerlessness and obscurity. Let no one remember his name or his deeds.
Well, he's working on that because that event that he showed up for in Florida today, I saw a video of it, Susan. Do you know how many people showed up to see him arrive, to catch a glimpse?
How about very few?
Double digits would be pushing it.
Good. But you're right.
It's kind of a damn shame that none of ours were there with some signs saying, indict, convict, imprison.
Yeah, that's what I want to see. I want to see him in the dock at The Hague, and his good buddy Cheney. I want them in the dock at The Hague, standing there, being sentenced in prison. And that would just suit me to a T. Because I'm mean. I don't want a nice, quick, clean execution. I want them to suffer.
But it ain't going to happen.
No. Well, that's one of the reasons I called in. If you look at the immigration code for the United States, you'll see that somebody who has an arrest on his record can't come into the United States. Why did we let that giggling chimp back into the United States?
Well, because it doesn't work that way. If you've got an arrest on your record in the United States, you can come and go as you please. It's other citizens that can't.
Crap. Any chance of sealing the border?
Well, no, he came and went from Canada apparently without issue.
Maybe getting him rendered or something like that to Germany. The thing we have to remember, and this is the way to stop these people and turn this country around. People, don't go out and run for congressman. Go out and run for your local school board. Because you know where all your school textbooks come from? Texas.
In California.
Yeah. And I don't know about you. Really would like to have the kids of this country taught civics and history again instead of social studies?
Well, beyond that, Susan, we've got a little bit of a battle brewing here in the hills and hollers. The Friends of Coal want to start teaching coal friendism to fourth graders next year in West Virginia schools.
In other words, you can opt out of sex ed, but you can't opt your kid out of being turning them into a coal bot.
Right. Let's say you're a poor family and you go to sign up for public assistance at the Department of Health and Human Resources in West Virginia, they've got Friends of Coal bracelets there to give away to your children.
Jesus Christ.
And, you know, look, if you can, if I know people may think, oh, God, he's gone off down that, he's doing that. No, there's a link here, Susan.
Yeah.
If you can be taught at an early age that it's okay to blow up your own neighbor's homes, well, blowing up somebody's home 10,000 miles away.
Exactly.
Well, that's.
Exactly.
That's child's play, isn't it?
Yeah, that's. You know, that's flipping a goodie on a game controller. That's all it is to them. And as far as the anniversary of the war, here's a link for you. The war and today's economy. All of these newspapers that are going under, and everybody's beating their breast and saying, whoa, whoa, whoa. Not me. I'm saying, if they can't be bothered to print the truth, which they never did about the war, let them die.
Well, Susan, you know, I'm a little funky with that word. The truth, printing the truth. I would have been, you know what? We could have kept this war from happening if the dirty little bastards, the lazy little junked up freaks. The Johnny on the spot Washington press corps would have just printed the facts. Truth is always malleable. The facts would have done nicely.
Yeah, exactly. They couldn't even be bothered to notice. It was all rah, rah, rah. Fine. In that case, all rah, 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 right into, as I watched them, go down into chapter 13.
You know, Marty writes in from the coast. He says, execution is far too good for these villains. I want them all to be tried, convicted, and sentenced to life in Spandau prison right after they've spent years rebuilding it.
Oh, I love that. He has just lovely ideas.
Yeah, the Spandau Ballet.
Yeah. What I want to know is, does anybody know if it would be considered a threat to mail Dick Cheney on the bacon?
I'm sure they would find a way to consider it one. Be the same as mailing a bag of pretzels to Bush.
Yeah, it's not like, yes, we're telling him to eat it, but, you know, there's the idea. Maybe if we just send him some shoes.
There you go.
But they're not worth the postage. These people don't care what we think. They never cared. They never will. What they care about is themselves. I want them stripped of everything they own. RICO! Racketeering statutes, wherever you are. We can always use them.
If only, if only. Yeah. Susan, good talking to you, dear.
It's good talking to you, and give my love to everybody.
I sure will.
Okie doke.
Take care.
Have a nice day.
You too. Bye. News Ninja Susan from Columbia City, Oregon. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello, Bob.
Hello.
This is Larry.
Yeah, hi, Larry.
Down here in Florida.
Indeed.
Hey, one thing I need to get is a new email address.
Oh, you know, I've announced that from time to time. But I couldn't. The old one dropped dead on me. Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid, @gmail.com.
Okay, Bob and Kincaid are all one word?
Yeah, just run it all together.
Okay. Okay, that'll help. And,
you know, I often wonder how many emails I've missed out on because I try to announce and, you know, but you never know who's getting what.
Yeah. Well, that's the way it goes. Sometimes it's good to retire an old one anyway because they get loaded up with spam.
Well, that's kind of where it had gotten with mine, but it was more of it, we ran up against a money wall, too.
Oh. Hey, you hit my button today, you know. You know, like Pogo, I don't think we really need to go very far except maybe to the mirror in the bathroom to blame for all this stuff.
We have seen the enemy, and he is us.
Yeah, I mean, really? anybody with a double-digit IQ should have seen that the WMD stuff was a lie. I mean, really. There were inspectors in there going anywhere they wanted, and they weren't finding anything. That should have been a big clue to a lot of people.
You would think, but it wasn't. I mean, for heaven's sakes, Larry, there were statements made by both Cole and Powell before the war, and the Condoleezza Rice, on tape, recorded, saying Saddam Hussein poses no threat to anyone, not even his neighbors.
Yeah,
and that just disappeared down the memory hole, I guess.
And then they started talking about mushroom clouds. Now, you know, just down the river from you there in Ohio, the Ohio Valley Electric Company was built with two big generating stations to supply the Portsmouth, Ohio uranium enrichment plant. It took that much electric power to enrich uranium. My gosh, Iraq at that time couldn't keep the lights on. How are they going to be building nuclear weapons?
Yeah, when you consider, the scope is right.
And then there's these crazy things like, the Scud missiles are hidden in caves, and they've been there for the last 12 years. Well, I don't know, you probably have caves in West Virginia.
And I was around quite a few of them growing up in Alabama, too. And they're wet.
You put your car in there for a few years and see if it runs.
Yeah, there was the science, the real, live, honest-to-goodness, hard science, Larry, that said even if he's got chemical weapons, they're chemical weapons left over from the first Bush War, and they don't work anymore.
That's right. And then he was going to use chemical weapons, and he was going to encircle Baghdad with a cloud of, chemical weapons.
Oh, and, well, remember, he was going to build a moat, too, Larry. Remember the moat?
Yeah, well, you don't have to be real bright to figure out that if you encircle yourself with poison gas, you're downwind.
Sooner or later, the wind shifts. I mean, it, even in Iraq.
And stuff like that.
God, I hadn't thought about the moat, though. He has trenches around the city of Baghdad, which he will immediately flood with crude oil and light on fire.
And those caves, nobody ever called in a geologist to find out if there really are caves in Iraq.
Well, don't there kind of have to be some mountainous structures, or maybe some limestone, something that can be eroded? I mean, I know when you get off in the desert, like down the Sinai and stuff, there are big rock walls there that have caves chiseled in, but they were dug.
Yeah.
Because caves are the existence of caves are predicated upon the existence of water.
Right. And even if they've been dry for a long time, they're not pleasant places to be. But at the time, I would say this and even point out to people with a military background that, look, Iraq had been overflown every day for years. None of their forces could have had any training in using the WMD. Did you ever think of that? I mean, you don't just take complicated weapon systems out and use them without having been trained on them in the field.
Yeah, all too true.
Stupidity has its downside, and we're there because we were stupid.
Oh, my. Yeah, well, because we were Larry, some stupidity attaches to us, but I can't give a pass to the loyal Bushies on that account. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, no, but we have to take some blame for not either agree or just laughing at the guy and taking him off to the funny farm when he caved in on that stuff. He knew it was lies. He couldn't be that dumb. Nobody's that dumb.
No. And see, that you open up an ancillary can of worms, Larry, because out of all of this, I mean, if all these military leaders that Myers, Richard Myers, and the General this and Admiral that, that were so gung-ho for all of this, if those guys actually believed that Saddam Hussein was a threat to the United States and bought into all the bogus, phony, dummied-up, ginned-up, faked-up, frauded-up, rubed-up the information and so-called intelligence, from time to time, and it still occurs to me, if we actually ever do face a threat, we're in real trouble because our brass are a bunch of dummies.
Yeah, well, you know, I spent a lot of time working with them, and they have a culture where they most of them spend most of their career kissing up to the guy above them. They cannot get up, I don't know if I can say it on the radio, but you know what I mean. They don't have any.
Yeah, actually, you can say it, but I respect your sense of decorum, and I honor it. But no, they are found wanting.
And that's most of them. You know, there are a few good eggs there, but most of them have not gotten there by hard work and smarts. They got there by just pleasing the guy above them, and they're just terribly afraid of offending each other, even. And they're supposed to be the warriors.
Yeah, it's a downer. It is, and I think our good friend Eugene Finnerman would probably chime in on this. It is a downright, the United States military hierarchy has become a downright Byzantine bureaucratic structure where everybody's so busy bowing and scraping to each other that doing the actual business of the military is sort of by the wayside.
Yeah, that's the way I kind of divided it up. There were, you know, the vast majority of them were dandies. You know, it was what was going on at the officers' club and the social.
Do you remember? I'm sure you know your history quite well. Do you remember the descriptions of George Pickett in the Civil War?
Yeah.
He appeared at dances with his ringlets oiled.
Yeah.
Perfumed. It's a culture that has been a while in the growing, but it's been there. Yeah. And compare that to the lewd and lascivious Grant, who could, you know, had days he could barely get into his saddle because he was, you know, drunk and cigarred up.
Yeah.
Who won?
There are those, and that's probably most of them. There are also there's a contingent of what I call goons, who are intent on killing people. And then there is a small contingent of actually competent people who usually don't last very long.
Well, I was on the way over to D.C. We stopped for lunch in Lexington, Virginia. The home of VMI and Washington and Lee University, and you know how I am about not doing corporate restaurants where possible. We stopped for lunch in a little place that it was some little diner on the main drag in Lexington. Is a tiny little charming Virginia town. It was something like the South Inn or some Southlander or whatever. But on the way out, I noticed that, you know, that VMI, being Virginia Military Institute, being the alma mater of sorts of Stonewall Jackson, because he was an instructor of artillery there before the war, he has some fame there. I think they've got his horse stuffed at VMI in the museum or something. If they could have Stonewall Jackson stuffed, I'm sure they would. But at any rate, there was a photograph hanging of him, and it was that official photo. A lot of people have seen it. He's staring dead on at the camera. And, you know, they called him Old Blue Light because his eyes had that raptorish
piercing glare to them, and they were this unnatural shade of blue. And even in that photograph, they stare out at you. And that man was just—he was a bloody butcher, and at the same time, of course, Larry, a profound Christian.
Yeah.
Wouldn't fight on Sunday. Wouldn't slaughter on Sunday. And yet, at the same time, when someone praised the Yankee soldiers and how hard they fought, and they said, "You know, what do we do about them?" Jackson answered, "Kill them. Kill them all."
Yeah, it's unfortunately fortunate that we even need anything like that.
But he was a genius.
Yeah, but we certainly need to keep it under control.
And that's the thing. You've got to have your genius killers in leadership, but you do have to keep them under control. You know, the George Patton was as mad as a March hare. You know, anybody who could stand on a battlefield and say, "God help me, I love it so." Oh, you know, while the cries of the dead, the dying, and the mortally wounded were ringing in one's ear, "God help me, I love it so." You know, there's something a little, you know, something mad about that. But those guys, those are the guys you want at the head of things, I guess, when you have to get down to that bloody business. But I don't know where those guys are now. I mean, look at the history of our generalship over the last 40 or 50 years. You get Stormin' Norman Schwarzkopf, who, as Bart Kopp today noted, was the guy who forgot to tell anybody not to let the helicopters fly during George Bush's daddy's war, and thereby enabled the slaughter up in the north. You know, he gassed his own people. That part of it. Well, that lands on Norman Schwarzkopf's desk because he forgot to make sure that the Iraqi helicopters stayed out of the air. But, William Westmoreland in Vietnam, you know, our buddy Bob just called in a few minutes ago. I'm sure he'd have a few choice words about William Westmoreland.
Oh, yeah, body counts.
Colin Powell, whose idea of waging war was to bomb everything that lived, and then send your ground forces in to mop up. Yeah, you know, these are regarded as America's leading military lights. It's not a comforting thought.
Well.
I mean, we did have some who did the right thing. You had some who looked up and said, "This war is madness," and they got early retirement.
Right, right. Yeah, there was one that was pretty good, General Odom. He's dead now, but he had some sense, actually.
Yeah, but the George Marshalls, they're gone.
Yeah, but it's
Omar Bradley. We'll not see his like again.
Yeah.
Even Eisenhower.
You know, we stand for it. You know, it's like the financial crisis. I'm not sure that's, you know, you can't blame all of that on Wall Street. You know, we should have been smart enough to not play the casino. But, you know, remember that advertisement on TV, this guy that's, you know, he's a real good-looking guy, and he gets up in the morning in his beautiful house, and he hits one key on his laptop, and he spent more money to, you know, with one key than he makes all week.
Yes.
Whatever happened to working for a little?
I know. I said to somebody earlier today that every time I go to a metropolitan area, I get myself in trouble. I mean, not like getting arrested trouble, but I get myself in existential trouble. Because I see everything that it takes to keep a city going, because it doesn't take nearly as much to keep a little rural area going as it does a full-on city. And I think about the people who pick up the trash and the guy who drives the street sweeper at 3 a.m., and I can't help thinking, Larry, that those men ought to go home to princely mansions.
Yeah.
Because they're really doing something.
The people who pick up my garbage work harder than anybody I know of. And, you know, and you think about the CEO makes, what, 400 times what the average worker makes, or, you know, some ridiculous spread there. And I wonder, does he work 400 times as hard? Is he 400 times as smart?
He doesn't work one-fourth as hard.
Right, but...
You know, yeah, I mean, I know you know. But, you know, think about that. Think about any of these goons on Wall Street. It would be kind of fun, because I know you know the book better than I do, even. It would be kind of fun to pull the Job trick on some of the Wall Street goons and start taking stuff away.
Yeah.
And the first thing we'll take away is his garbage man.
Right.
And then maybe we'll take away the maid. Upstairs and down. And then we'll take away the yard guy. And pretty soon, I mean, it won't be long at all before your average Wall Street bankster is crying, as the book says, Lord, Lord. And I want to be able to stand there and say, we hear you not.
Yeah. You know, and we've been and might still be in grave danger of having come to pass if we have a complete financial meltdown.
Sadly, yes, and that'll hurt the guy who's, you know, see, I don't want to hurt the guy picking up the garbage.
Yeah, but the guy picking up the garbage can probably fend for himself.
In the long run, I think you're probably right. That's the thing. These are our Wall Street banksters and our AIG executives, you know, the ones with all that talent that had to have those bonuses because otherwise they'd go somewhere else and screw up even worse. They are the social and frankly human evolution equivalent of hothouse flowers.
Yeah. Well, you know, most of those people they were well enough family wise to get an MBA from an Ivy League school and moved right into the top levels of all this wheeling and dealing and really thought they knew what they were doing.
And they can't fix the floaty thing in their toilet when the toilet won't stop running.
Right. there are other people that I have great admiration for, and that the Cubans who keep those ancient cars going.
Oh. And build those hybridized systems so they'll run on kerosene.
Yeah. Now those are some clever people.
Necessity is a mother. Larry, let me shift gears on you real quick. Are you going to the convention?
Oh yeah.
Well, you'll have to call and report in. I was hoping we could work out a way for maybe the horn to be broadcasting from there, but I guess it's not going to shake out. So we'll rely on you to be our correspondent on the ground. I'd love to have been there to do a couple of interviews, like I said, I guess it's not going to shake out, but it sure would be fun. So I hope you will report back.
Okay. I'll try to do that. If not on the scene, why, maybe after the fact.
That'd be fine too.
We got a heavy hitter in there.
Oh yes, you do. That was one of the, to sit down and interview Dr. Dawkins would be a beautiful thing. And then of course you got Malloy going to be there too.
Right.
And I'm babbling on about the atheist convention. Around April the
10th.
Yeah. And there's going to be a big debaptism on Sunday.
Right.
I think that's a beautiful thing.
Malloy has gone independent. I don't know. He went through about two networks there. And is there something going on with, you know, liberal talk radio?
You mean apart from the fact that it's collapsing?
Yes, that's...
let's see. Jones Radio turned into Dial Media. Tom Hartman ended his affiliation with Air America to go to Dial, and I imagine Dial will get him on a lot more stations. So Dial's got Hartman and Stephanie and... that other guy, big Schultz.
Yeah.
Schultz! And they're very similar in my book, the TV character and the radio character. So that's going on there. Nancy Skinner and Mike Malloy are both self-syndicating. And now I saw an ad on BartCop today for another individual, and I recognize her name. I can't come up with it off the tip of my tongue right now. But she has gone to this subscription self-syndication model as well. And so while the Horn doesn't do subscriptions per se, we just rely on people to do what they can, how they can. We created an internet model 3.5 years ago that a lot of liberal talkers are coming around to now. Either by necessity or by recognition of its viability.
I noticed that Malloy is being carried on White Rose servers.
Yes. I don't know the complete details of that. That's something that Mike and Ben have worked out. But you know, I think they'll succeed. I think they'll be able to do and get what they need. And I'm awfully proud that Ben is a part of it because, you know, I'm not kidding every night at the end of the program when I say that he literally saved liberal talk on the internet when he opened up the White Rose in 2002. Imagine if Ben wasn't there.
Yeah.
Where would people go?
I guess we'd be dittoing.
Yes. Let's don't and say we didn't, Larry.
But the
one difference is that the Horn continues to persist in our dogged determination that one may survive on the internet alone. I don't know how I would even begin to go about finding a radio station interested in carrying me, because what we do here simply can't work on terrestrial radio as we are currently formatted. I mean, I opened the mic at 6 p.m. I haven't played so much as a song in an hour and 27 minutes. It's just been straight-on conversation. Maybe that drives some people mad, Larry. I don't know. I assume if it did, I would get some flack via email. But you've got to stop and sell stuff on terrestrial radio because for all the intent of whoever the individual hosts are, it is the delivering products to potential purchasers that drives the terrestrial radio medium itself.
Yeah. And I have a feeling that if the the ideological slant is not right, bought and format changed because they didn't like, you know, somebody didn't like the slant.
Well, even, can you imagine? Now, I mean, I just spent a few days, and I've spent several few days in Washington, D.C. lately, and I'm here to tell you that is not a conservative town. And yet there is not one liberal progressive talk station in D.C. anymore. Not one, Larry. Not one. Now, do you suppose that's because there's no market for it? Now, to be fair, there's Pacifica. But they're not commercial.
Right.
But there is not one commercial liberal talk station in Washington, D.C.
I know. I used to spend a lot of time there.
And, I mean, how can that be anything but the refusal of the people who hold the licenses to put the format on? Because you can't tell me that you can have three stations running flush flimball and be turning a hearty profit to an audience that has not 10 cents worth of interest in anything that drug-addled gas bag has to say. It defies something you and I are terribly fond of, namely reality.
But if you have a lot of money, I guess you can buy the radio stations and buy the bandwidth.
And shovel the ideology for all you're worth. Because again, there are structures out there that will support that right wing hate and filth and nastiness in general. Whereas liberals and the so-called left remain so far about generally. I'm not talking about folks who listen to the liberal programming. I'm talking about the people who have enough money to burn a wet elephant. They're so far behind the curve on this, they still think they're on straight road.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's been good talking to you.
Larry, it's awfully good talking to you, and I look forward to seeing your communications again. I'm sorry I had no way. I didn't know that you didn't have the Addy. So everybody out there, not just Larry, Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid, @gmail.com. I hope all's going well with you, Larry.
Yeah. Retirement's nice.
Make that long walk to the mailbox.
Okay.
All right. Take care, Larry.
Okay, bye.
Bye now. Our buddy Larry calling from Florida. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello? Hello? Anybody there? Okay, on the odd chance that, because usually it's a beeping, on the odd chance that somebody is there, we will go back to hold and try again in a minute. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Brother Bob, how are we today?
Brother Albert, how are you?
Oh, I was just talking to St. Peter, and he says you guys don't have anything to worry about when it comes to Reckoning Day, because, you know, you guys are aware, and you're paying attention. Like Bob was talking earlier, I mean, a lot of this conversation has been being ripples off of each other. You know, you talk on one hand, you know, you got right-wingers are the ones who put up the money, for Air America to start with. They're the ones that are on the boards of these companies that advertise on these things, and they own the radio stations as well. You know, they're on the boards of those things. I mean, it's not surprising that these are the same people that would cheerlead a war, and while, you know, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, if not billions of people, you know, in their heart of hearts did scream no, and that's why we have what we have is failure. I mean, you know, if the whole world was behind success in Iraq and the whole world thought that was a good thing, we wouldn't have lost. It would be just like when people went against Nazism and the Japanese Empire and everything else like that. I mean, those things got crushed, you know, and I think what we see here today, I hope that what we can wind up doing is dismantling this empire ourselves. You know, if the people that were building, following Nimrod back in the day would have just, maybe we should just start taking this thing down. Yeah, they wouldn't have had the problems. We'd all be still speaking the same language. Hallelujah. Right? We'd still be speaking in tongues.
Yeah, now see, when you said Nimrod, I wondered if you were going for the real one or the one that was the one that just left office a couple of months ago. But no, I understand. You were talking about the real Nimrod. Well, the sort of real mythical Nimrod.
Yeah, well, whatever that is. we can't forget Bush. The little turd has served a purpose. He's served a deed to humanity. I mean, it's akin to Hitler, but it's still nonetheless, it's a valuable lesson. You know, it's an important thing that these people have run away with their greed and collapsed the system. It's an important thing, because if not, then these injustices would continue. These kinds of, this mindset would continue. The greed thing would continue. People wouldn't be talking about it. They'd still be driving Hummers and thinking that's a good idea. And, we're over here talking about, of course, Glenn Beck and the other freaks, they'll talk about, they're going to take the weapons away, they're taking our guns away, and all that stuff. And they're saying that it's like, the hyped up thing regarding Mexico. But the real people don't understand, they're not hearing, but the real thing that people are actually talking about with it when it comes to Mexico and these drug gangs and the violence and all this other stuff, where the hell are they getting the money to buy the guns? Okay, hang on. Let's take that money away from them. There is no more guns. Or they'll have their guns, they'll try to rob the little bank, and then they'll, of course, these things are out there. Regardless, you're not going to go, how are you going to get these guns from the gang members? You're not. But you could take their money away so they can't buy any more. You know what I'm saying? Like, they'll have to go steal it, and then they get caught, and so on and so forth. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
There's only one answer to that. It's the same answer that, what was that guy I just heard on the, I think it was on the TV. I heard you, honey. The thing on the TV where they're talking, there is a medicinal cannabis place that paid $500,000 in business tax. $500,000. Now that, Obama's been doing a bunch of things, and I've seen the Alex Jones crap, and really all he's got with that little video that you mentioned earlier is, the ties to Brzezinski, and, a couple little, he met the Bilderbergs and all that other stuff.
Yeah, but if you start playing 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon with anybody in Washington, it'll go to 8 degrees.
Oh, absolutely, and that's why, Alex Jones, he serves a purpose, and I believe, I'm on your camp, your side of this camp here. I mean, he's a little bit of a huckster, and he knows he's got a product, and he kind of has, knows how to sell it, but hey, at least he's calling attention to making people go, hey, wait a minute, yeah, these guys are all buddies, but the 6 degrees, I agree, it goes a little bit too far and gets a little bit too crazy, but regardless, people need to be somewhat aware of these things. If you're aware of these things, and if you know there's a trap, you can evade it.
Albert, that guilt by association thing, I was blown away when, like I said last night, and I was really, really tired and in more or less of a stupor, whether I made any sense or not remains to be seen, but I was completely just shocked when I walked a half a block from the hotel and saw Mary Surratt's boarding house in Washington, D.C., in Chinatown, on 8th Street. You know, the place, yeah, she put up a bunch of Southern sympathizer boarders who paid their rent, and I guess she cooked them dinner and stuff. And then John Wilkes Booth shot Abraham Lincoln, and they hanged her for it. You know, that's guilt. That's a classic case of guilt by association. We don't know to this day whether or not she knew anything about the plot to kill Lincoln, whether or not she took any sort of a substantial step or overt act in support of the conspiracy. What we do know is that she owned a boarding house and that some of the conspirators stayed there.
Yep. Well, it's like that poor sucker, that 18-year-old kid, 20-year-old kid, whatever, John Walker Lind, who was over there, studying to be, he wanted to be Islamic, and then he was wrapped up with these guys, and he got rounded up, and now he's in prison for the rest of his life. The leaders of this little group of people were, giving problems to the United States to give back Osama bin Laden, and so then he is then therefore responsible for being a terrorist and, this and that. I mean, we still have that to this moment. But I hear you, and when you sit there and you think about politics and you think about, or finance, this guilt by association thing, I mean, you got your conspirators of, if they can conspire, like, if Booth and all these other people, they can all conspire, well, why can't they, you don't think these people in AIG?
I was about to say exactly that, Albert. Now, you want a conspiracy? I mean, you don't have to ask anything about anything falling down, or was it pushed, or did it jump, or anything. There's evidence out there. There are facts. Not evidence.
Facts.
There are facts out there
mm-hmm.
that show clearly that there were massive conspiracies involved in the subprime crisis, involved in derivative swaps. The whole derivative thing was a giant conspiracy. The idea of we're going. Who put it like this? I think it was Bill Maher last week. I got around to watching the show. It was the YouTube links were sent to me last night. He described it as selling insurance, but it's not really insurance because if it was insurance, there'd have to be money behind it. But there's no money behind it, so it's not insurance, but it's like insurance.
Yeah.
Well, Albert, let's be clear on this. You can't do that without a large and ongoing conspiracy.
Oh, absolutely. And I'll tell you. You were talking about this a little bit earlier too. Guys, come here. Come. You're talking about this a little bit earlier. The garbage men, the teachers, the nurses, these people should get paid far more than these other people get paid. And the reason I say this is when you're in the financial world, right, and you're sitting there and you're in the insurance business or whatever, and you can set policy that just all it does is enrich your own pocket, like presidents, isn't there supposed to be ethic laws? Like, oh, you're not supposed to, you know, do like Dick Cheney did and start these fake bullcrap wars because, you know, you're Halliburton, you know, and all the, you know, you're not supposed to give them the contracts because it's going to enrich you. Like, just that alone should, like, almost in a sense cap everybody on Wall Street salary.
Yeah, that's called, that's called self-dealing, and it's supposed to be a massive sin. I mean, a big no-no, you know, just the skulls and crossbones, all, and if you do it, it's terrible things. You're supposed the earth is supposed to yawn open and swallow you whole if you'd self. But self-dealing is all we had once George Bush pulled the pillars out from under the regulatory agencies.
Seriously? Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I mean, he has SEC violations up the yin yang as it is. But, you know, when we sit here and think about it, you know, let him have a 901K or something crazy like that to retire with. But while they're working and while they're sitting there maintaining our financial infrastructure, they can, like, actually, you know, think about it because they wouldn't be, give them 100 grand a year. 100 grand a year is decent money. Yeah, you can survive on that very fairly easily, I would imagine. And, you know, I mean, because really all these guys are salesmen. Right? That's all they are. I mean, the stockbrokers, they're salesmen. They don't know jack squat about anything. That's why they're stupid. That's why the financial news, they tell them what to do. They jump up and down the hoops. They go and they say, oh, don't you see it on CNBC? This is what I can get you. Oh, I can get you 50% returns on your money. Oh, in 6 months. I mean, you know, and then you got Bernie Madoffs and all these other just bastards. How does it feel to be a billionaire, Mr. Stanford? It feels good.
It's good.
Yeah. Shut him up. This ride is real. It has to be real. Look at my bank account. Look at my sorrows of worry. Yeah, I mean,
oh, peace be upon him.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you know, but in a sense, I think that's what he was talking about regarding this ride. You see, we're in charge in that way, because we're the ones that sat here and scream and scream and scream, and even in the overdrome and just to have, we were, you know, drowned out and all this media, and it didn't work. Like the way the media was during the first Gulf War, I mean, Bob, it was everything was rah, 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 rah.
Hey, look here. Here's the luckiest man in Iraq. How, how, how.
Oh, look at those bombs. Oh, yeah. You know, and, you know, that glorification and, you know, of, I mean, even the war movies back in those days, you know, like a lot of people didn't even really get them, you know, like they thought, you know, like, oh, Full Metal Jacket, oh, that's a great movie, so on and so forth, until it gets to the war part and then it gets boring. It's like, because you don't understand that that's a movie about actual, it's like a protest movie. It's a movie about how we can turn people into something that we just aren't, and how peer pressure can do this, and how war is going to stay. Yeah, he feels he's singing Mickey Mouse now, but wait till he gets home. Wait till he does this. You know, like we should have been able to see the truth behind those things then. And
Michael J. Fox did a decent and underappreciated movie along those lines. What was it? Casualties of War.
Yep. And Kevin Bacon's in that one, too.
There we go.
He's in everything, but you can't get away from Kevin Bacon.
No, and good for him, because I hear he's a decent guy.
Yeah. Oh, I do, too. I mean,
I got to tell you, when I walked two blocks down H Street to the metro station and stood there across from Fuddruckers, I just had to wonder if I went into the rubble, if I just dug down beneath it, what would I find?
And just, you need a time capsule, come out 500 years, you know what it would say then.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, no, well,
St. God's Memorial, St. God's Memorial Church was across from my window, yeah.
St. God's. Oh, you know, but that, when Carl's Jr. buys up, you know, the radio stations and then pays the advertisers to protect their interests. I mean,
oh, look, yeah, you know, there were, we were two blocks, across from Fuddruckers was Starbucks. And when one of the guys looks at me and says, I'm going down to Starbucks, I said, well, that's great, but I really don't think we've got time for a hand job. Oh, the looks you get when you quote Idiocracy to someone who hasn't seen it.
Water. You mean like in the toilet? with
Oh, and see, it's now infected my children.
It has, but that's good because.
Oh, it is because you know I looked at them. I looked at the girls and I said, "I'm going across the street to the little grocery store. You want anything? You want some pop, some Gatorade?" And then I said, "Gatorade." Margie looks up and says, "It's got electrolytes."
That's right. Forgot what plants crave. And they do sell Brondo, by the way.
Oh, I know.
They really do. It's a real, actual product.
Marketed by Fox.
Yeah, well, of course. But they don't even see. And that's the other thing about Fox. I don't understand how they do that. They're just whores. That's all that is. Those guys, I mean, what did he say? What's his name? Communist that they're so afraid of. About how the capitalists will sell you the rope to hang himself. And you know, they do it all, you know. Oh, Family Guy, it's like all they do is destroy. I mean, it's like everybody watches Family Guy because it's making fun of the channel. It's like I think half the people that, you know, Fox talks about their ratings, I think half of them are just watching so they can post it on the Internet. You know what I mean? I mean,
yeah.
It's almost like Fox watching became a sport back in the, you know, in the Bush years. And, you know, it just became, it's almost like one of those BME videos or one of those other more horrid things on the Internet. It's like one of those... I know it would be for me. It's like, you know,
I did Mark Levine's TV show Monday night while I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking a little bit about what the selenium and all the poisons that get dumped into our water here in West Virginia do. And I said, "Mark, you've seen The Simpsons?" "Oh yeah." "You know, at the beginning of the program in the intro, when it shows that three-headed fish, or used to before they had to take it out because the nuclear industry complained, that three-headed fish in the water near the nuke plant?" "Yeah." "Or that three-eyed fish?" I said, "Well, we have three-eyed fish in the waters of West Virginia now."
"Yep."
"Because of selenium. It's what it does." And you know, the weird mirroring of reality in satire, of course, that's what good satire is supposed to do. But, yeah, it's...
Well, see, I think people see that, Bob. I mean, I told you, we stopped the coal ash dump that they were going to put out here. And you see everywhere dump Dairyland Power, which is the big coal burning, you know, plant that we have, you know, shortly, you know, down the river a little bit. And now they want to put a CAFO up. Now, you know what a CAFO is? I live in Vernon County in Wisconsin, and we're probably about one of the poorest counties in the state, if not the poorest. And we also have the lowest population. But this is an organic mecca out here. And, you know, so per capita is one of those things. And the cows out here are happy. And not for nothing to the meat lovers out there, they taste good.
Yeah, made from contented cows, right? Somebody had a slogan like that once upon a time.
Well, happy cows are, you know, I mean, not for nothing. You know, you have that lady who has autism who goes and makes the slaughterhouses more efficient and less terrifying, which is, she does this by making it less terrifying for the animals. Well, that's better for the animals because, you know, not for nothing. You know, we're going to utilize animals. Let's at least treat them with respect. So what they want to throw out here now within, you know, a couple miles of my house, they want to put a CAFO, which is a concentrated animal feed operation.
Where they a cow schwitz.
Exactly. You know, and I mean, I see, that's exactly what I thought. I'm like, this is like a, you know, and I don't want to sound like a PETA freak or anything like that, but my goodness gracious, what else is that? If you're not even going to let these animals...
Look, you work for the, and see, having one of those brings terrible, terrible things beyond the actual real world consequences of that thing existing anywhere near you, because it's nasty enough by itself. But the people who, out of desperation of some sort, go to work there, bad things happen to them because, you know, just like we found out that Adkisson had Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity and Michael Savage books back home before he decided to go kill some liberals at the Unitarian Church in Knoxville. Well, it turns out that the poor sod who shot up South Alabama a week or so ago, that guy had been and his mother, whom he killed execution style and then
arranged the animals around her like, you know, some sort of ancient burial ritual. I think we talked about this. That guy had been dehumanized inside a Pilgrim's Pride chicken processing slaughter facility for years.
Yes.
You don't want the food that comes out, and you don't want what happens to the people who come out.
Yeah, it's just not a.
And I'm sure if the county, Vernon County, is as rural as what you described, Albert, I'm pretty sure there's some people on wells there, not on city water.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah. Oh, cities are on wells.
You don't want that thing getting into your groundwater, because it's not just poo, okay, which is bad enough. It's all the stuff that's in the food they feed. It's in the antibiotics. I'm preaching to the choir. You know this.
Oh yeah. Oh, I know all about it. We're not sitting still. I mean, it was negative freaking 18 degrees out, and I got a knock on my door, and it was my librarian, and she's the one who told me that, oh, here, we just got rid of the coal ash dump, and here now they want to do this. And, you know, I mean, it's going to blow up. I mean, it's just going to blow up in their face again. We're not going to allow it. And that's the thing. And that's the thing that, you know, Little Vernon County, we're not going to allow it. You know, it comes to a point of, you know, we don't care if somebody thinks that they're going to see a 50% energy. We're not going to allow it. We're just not going to sit here and sit by while somebody rapes something of nature. I mean, and that's just the sad thing. I mean, the real sad thing is this guy, you know, he's greedy. He wants to make some more money. He's not making enough money. He wants more money. He wants more money. Okay, so he wants more money. Well, he already has, you know, tens of thousands of acres. Dude, if you got tens of thousands of acres, you've got plenty of room for plenty of cows that you can actually raise on grass, treat with respect, do this, do that. You can sell it as organic, grass-fed Angus or whatever freaking butterball cow. I don't even know what kind of cows we got anymore. You know, but you could do all kinds of different things like that and, like, maintain it and keep it part of the ecosystem and maintain a certain balance. You know, and maybe I got a little bit just in me or what have you, but, you know, that's why I can actually respect the reason that Bush exists. And it's to show us these things that are just wrong. And I think that, you know, like, I mean, the resistance that people are seeing here for a CAFO now and for a coal ash dump now is not something that would have existed 15, 20 years ago. Yeah, maybe, but not as much. And I think as we see now, it's just like these things become, you know, this know that everybody listens to the horn. Nobody's got to worry about, you know, hearing any kind of, getting any finger wagging, you know, by St. Peter on that day. Or whatever, that moment. You know, I don't think anybody that listens to the horn really needs to sweat that. Because we're aware, we're listening to the consciousness scream no about war and killing children history, because we know it's important and we teach our children why it's important. We sit there and we take them and we show them these things, like you're doing what you're, you know, you've been taking your children to Washington D.C. and showing them around and, you know, letting them, you know, kind of get grounded to the reality that we're in. You know, at the same time, you're not extinguishing the mere fact that we have a responsibility to change this crap. And I think we are. I think we're winning, Bob. I can't, you know, I don't see.
Well, you know, there's winning going on a bunch of different fronts, Albert. And, you know, we've talked at length on a number of occasions, for instance, about hemp.
Okay. Oh, absolutely.
And then you can extend the discussion to medical marijuana. I don't know if you saw it today or not, but Eric Holder, the Attorney General, sent a big, huge signal about medical marijuana. Did you catch this?
Really? No, I didn't.
He stated that contrary to the Bush administration's position, and this sort of opens the can of worms about, you know, the problems inherent in our system, that everything good that can happens can be undone by a madman. And that's why an administrative fix, for instance, to mountaintop removal won't work. It has to be legislative and it has to be outright banned. The Bush administration had taken had gone around suing and carrying on and arresting people and so forth over, these medical marijuana, outlets that, like you mentioned, in, California.
Ed Rosenthal, the McCormick, Todd McCormick, they're trying to they were trying to extradite Mark Emery from Canada,
right.
Vancouver 3.
All that stuff. Well, that's over.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tommy Chong, remember him?
Yeah. Oh, Jesus. That's over.
Yeah.
Eric Holder said either today or yesterday that the Department of Justice, given its limited resources, will only pursue violators, people who violate both state and federal law where marijuana is concerned. In other words, a medical marijuana retailer in California is abiding by California law, but technically violating federal law. Well, Holder says they'll only prosecute those who are violating both. Now, there's some indication that there's been some inequity in that under Holder already, but if going forward that's the direction it's going to take, I say hallelujah. But you want the real sign of change? I got it for you here, and in fact, Horn listeners can go and kind of blow this thing up a little bit. There is a poll. In a most unlikely place, you know, it's an internet poll, it's not scientific or anything. It is at the website of the Anniston Star. Anniston is a community, a town in east central Alabama.
Okay.
It is home to, you know, lots of military types, Anniston Army Depot, that kind of thing. I think it's still open. They poisoned the ground, and yada, yada, yada. But that's all beside the point. The website is AnnistonStar.com. 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 And today, I was alerted by our pal Loretta Nall. You remember Loretta.
Yes, I know Loretta a long time.
I got an email from her today alerting me to this poll on the main page of the Anniston Star. Query. Should Alabama legalize marijuana? Now, without putting too fine a point on things, this is Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is a state that repeatedly sends a man to the United States Senate who once said, "I used to think the Klan was pretty cool till I found out they smoked the marijuana." No, really, Jeff Sessions. Not kidding.
Really.
There is a poll question on the main page at AnnistonStar.com, Albert. Should Alabama legalize marijuana? The potential answers are yes, Alabama needs the tax revenue. Yes, but only for specific medical purposes. And no, it should remain illegal. Sit down, Albert.
All right. I read that beforehand.
Okay.
Go ahead.
The yes, Alabama needs the tax revenue, and yes, for only medical purposes, amount to 68% of the vote. 31%, no, it'll turn my little girl into a communist. You know, 31% are still there. 68% of respondents, and this is, 439 people. Now, granted, that's not a big sample, but you know what? Horn listeners can go and click.
Yes, sir. Oh, I mean, you know, you sit there, but...
But that's still pretty stunning for that community, because that's the daily paper of that community.
Oh, consciousness, baby. It's consciousness. I mean, people at the level that we live, you know, we don't live with the mad, power-hungry nonsense, and most of us don't. And, you know, we live, you know, in a sense, in a world of, we try to make rational common sense, and we try to make our world kind of work that makes sense, use things efficiently and this and that. And, you know, everybody who's experienced, you know, getting a little high on cannabis knows that it's not all the horror stories. And now we see the medical evidence to show that it's actually none of those things that they used to tell us about it was true. We also now we're starting to see, oh, my God, we waste a ton of money and energy and resources, you know, hiring people to walk through, you know, picking out a field while, you know, nonetheless in California and Alabama, that's one thing. Alabama could grow hemp. Forget it. I mean, they would grow hemp. I just got to say this. The medical marijuana or the cannabis plant that people smoke for the recreation of medical uses Okay, that is the number one cash crop in the state of California. The number one cash crop. You know,
it's the number one cash crop in the United States.
Yeah, and that's another thing. Exactly, it's a number one cash crop in the country, and that's just the herb. You know, the herb is grown in closets and in little patches all over the place, and it's the number one. You know, I live in farm country here, bud, and I'll tell you what, man, that's mind-blowing. That's staggering to think that the level of cornfields and everything that we have in this country and in California, which is such a gigantic state on its own right, you know, the real estate, the grapes take off and all this other stuff, but cannabis is the number one cash crop. And then we spend what? Billions and billions and billions of dollars, right? Billions of dollars, paying other countries billions of dollars to go blow billions of dollars in chemicals to spray on their farmland, and then we can sell them our product. Oh, disgusting. Anyway, you know, we sit here and blow all this money, then we jail people and do this and do that and give three strikes and, you know, all these other things that we're just doing is just stupid. It's not sustainable. And, you know, there is another, you know, there's a lot of things like this going on in just in the consciousness. I mean, you sit there and you hear this debate, right, and here's the answer. You know the answer. But, oh, what's worse for you? Hummers or toilet paper? What's worse for the planet? Well, toilet paper is, absolutely. You know, we talk about if cannabis, the herb is the number one cash crop. You know what hemp is going to look like compared to that? Hemp is going to make recreational medicinal pot, the money revenue generated, is going to look like pocket change compared to hemp. This is my personal belief. I believe the reason that pot is illegal, cannabis is illegal, is because of how useful hemp is.
Right. It's a gateway drug to industrial hemp, which seems really crazy, but I think it's entirely true.
Oh, my God. I mean, you sit there and you think, right?
You don't have to put Roundup on hemp because hemp's already a weed.
It's advanced, it does this, it does all these things, 40,000 industrial uses, it can be made into everything, toilet paper included. Here's one statistic that you gotta remember, and my friend brought up a point to this, because him and I were just talking about this last night. The old statistic from the Department of Agriculture in the 30s stated that 1 acre of hemp, one season, one harvest, 1 acre of hemp equals 4 acres of trees in terms of paper pulp production. 1 acre. The thing is you can plant that acre in a place like Alabama 4 times in a year.
Just about.
But essentially, all right, just about. Now think about this. 4 times a year, okay, because it takes about 3 months or 3-4 months to get going, right? You can sit there, harvest it 4 times a year, and that 1 acre becomes 12, 16 acres. You think about the kind of money, I mean, the raw material just impact of having the raw materials available in such a quantity that...
And remember, it's not soil depleting.
Oh, exactly. Well, heck, soil depleting. It is soil depleting in one way only that I'm aware of, is we'll clean up radioactive... This is the first thing I thought of when I heard of the Kentucky coal slurry slide. We need to go in there and plant hemp. That's what they did at Chernobyl to help clean that up, because one of the characteristics of the plant is it pulls up the radioactive isotopes and breaks them down, and then, you know, it kind of helps them decay faster. It does that with a bunch of them, and it's really very good for cleaning the soil, aerating the soil, you know, giving the soil nutrients back, putting nitrogen into the soil, because no other plant has a root system like these. These things are amazing. It really is. You sit there, and you start understanding anybody who wants to go look up something and see the history of hemp and how hemp can save this planet. I mean, from biofuel and paper and plastic and, I mean, diesel and everything that it can be done, it's just unbelievable, especially toilet paper. We waste the amount of trees. Now, this is the point. I was talking 1-to-4 ratio, right? He's like, no, I don't think that's the same anymore. Because back in the 30s, there were still old-growth forests that they used to calculate how much they would get. Nowadays, it's these forests that are, you know, these really quick poplars or whatever they're growing for 20 years. You know, they grow these things for 20 years. It takes 20 years. Well, a tree that's 20 years old is never going to, you know, equal. And this is what I love when they say, oh, there's so many trees in the country now. There's more trees than there were in 1800s. Yeah, but they're all little. A big tree does far more, just like a big elephant eats way more than a little elephant, a big tree puts out way more oxygen, sucks in way more carbon dioxide, it evaporates more water. It does so much more. It's a big tree. It helps, it's the anchor of a forest, are these old trees. You know, so, these little trees that we put in that are, with the redwoods. Freaking redwoods, 1,000-year-old tree, Bob. Come on. It's going to take 1,000 years. We're going to cut a tree and then plant one and say, oh, yeah, that's the same. That's the same. You cut a 1,000-year-old tree down, and you're going to say that the sapling is the same, the 3-year-old sapling?
Right, or some scraggly-ass pulp pine.
Exactly. Leave the trees. We can make, I'm sure we can do selective harvesting for furniture and meet all of our needs. Well, whatever we can't make out of hemp, because hemp may, this is one of those things. I was talking to my neighbor here. She's a sheriff, and she drives these roads all the time. And I was like, why did they make these? And she's like, well, they didn't have enough time. I'm like, but why did they make these roads so crappy? It almost feels like, we got the contract, and, we'll get the next contract. They only build it to, the contract would last 3 years.
Yeah, they built it to service it.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. They built it so they can keep rebuilding it constantly. And you think back, to all these places in Europe that weren't destroyed, but these roads in Europe, they survived World War II. They survived the Roman Empire. They were made back in the day. And, one of the components to this concrete that was made back in the day was hemp. And this concrete to this day is still driven on and ridden on and walked on. And, it's about building things, sustainability to me means building things to last out of products you can get again. If gold was plentiful at one time and now it's not, well, heck, you better stop using it for, hole in your face and hole in your ear. If it comes to this way, that's another one. Did you see the National Geographic? Did you see the cost of gold? Where, these poor people in Africa, in Zimbabwe and everything else like that, it's just as Bush trying to do the same thing here. But anyway, we get these, massive inflation rates, what is it, 11% or whatever. And now these people are like, well, I can't even, grow anything. I can't do nothing. I'm going to go out and dig a hole and dig up some gold and use some mercury and put it in the river. Oh, my God. And then that gold makes it to the market. Just like that coltan, man, we're just, we got to really, really readjust our situation here to, for just the fine points. There's some fine points.
It's fascinating that we talk about how, hemp can grow anywhere. There's one place hemp can't grow.
Hemp, I know you're going to say it, but I don't know if I believe you.
It's true.
Where can it grow?
Mountaintop on a former mountaintop removal site, where they've reclaimed. Can't grow there.
Yeah. You sure?
I'm sure.
I don't know.
No. There's got to be some sort of de minimis soil. It's not a freaking lichen. It can't grow in rock.
Well, that's true. That's true. But, if you did put a decent layer of topsoil on there, I'll tell you what.
No, that's down at the bottom of the valley, Albert.
Oh, right. I know. Well, I know. The best thing for those, I know that they're already made. They're hideous scars. They're just horrible. Everybody who's seen them knows this. Well, the only thing that I would think of to put there, what I think would fit perfectly there, as a monument to never doing it again, would be a windmill farm.
Can't put them there.
You can't put a windmill?
Nope.
Why not?
Well, for starters, because the mountain, by having been reduced, is taken down out of the industrial wind range. Secondly, because there is no solidity to what they've done, you can't anchor one. It won't stay put because the mountain's not staying put anymore because it's not a mountain anymore.
Jeez.
You can't put a golf course there because great crevasses open in them. You can't put a prison there because they can't get the doors to shut. They're trying to put schools there, but it'll be an unsafe, toxic place. You can't put much of anything on one, and that's why it's such a comic thing, Albert, when these meetings are convened to talk about post-mine land use.
It's striking me as like these places are just voids of reality. They don't even exist in the universe anymore because the spirit that, gave them life is gone. That's how I'm seeing, like, Spirited Away, this lost. Kiefer Mountain's spirit is gone, just wandering around in the bathhouse, you know, eating everything it can.
There you go.
I mean, yeah, that's sad. Well, yeah, we've got to do something with it. I don't know.
No, really, there's nothing. I mean, what we got to do is start, get it stopped. And then we can start thinking about, because nothing a coal company does after a coal company is done raping a mountain is ever done for anything less than or anything more than a de minimis appearance of having complied with their bond. See, just like when you get arrested for a crime and you get bailed out, you have to post a bond because you're a crook and you might run. Well, coal companies have to post a bond when they go to blowing up mountains because they're crooks and they're going to run. But whereas some guy who maybe gets busted for, you know, burglary, you know, he'll have to put up $100,000 bond, and he can't afford it, so he stays in jail. Well, the coal companies, the state says, put up something, okay? And the bond that they put up is never enough to clean up their filthy little mess when they bolt. Because they all bolt. You know, that's one of the essential facts of a boom and bust coal economy. They all bolt for the border. Boom, bust, bolt for the border.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the cycle.
Hey, what's that? There is a city out there that, I don't know, what's that city in West Virginia has the highest employment rate in the country? They had to deal with that, didn't they? Like the old coal. Isn't that in northern West Virginia? I mean, yeah, that's in northwest Virginia, the city up there. It's got a super low, but they basically, they're a small town. They do everything within themselves, and they, you know, when the coal jobs left, they kind of, you know, I don't know, maybe you should network up there and get those people, because they're a shining example of, you know, of a community being a community, which is, of course...
Right, and but the reason they were able to do that, and I know what you're talking about, but I'm not sure if it's West Virginia or not, but I know the town you're talking about, Albert, but the thing is, coal had to leave them first.
Yeah.
Coal had to leave them alone. See, that's kind of what happened here where I live. Coal did what it always did, does, you know, it treats a community like a John treats a hooker. It gets what it wants, throws a little change on the bed and leaves, and the community or the hooker is sort of sitting there sticky, broken, confused. And that happened to my area. And coal bolted for the border, and some people started looking around and noticing this really, really cool rivers. And they noticed that some people would come up and bring these funny canoes with pointy ends on both ends and a hole in the middle. And they seemed to derive some pleasure from putting their funny pointy on both ends canoes in the water and going down the river and getting real wet. And they'd make these fun noises like, whee-hoo, when they were going down the rapids. And some people put their heads together and thought, you know, people might pay to come and do that. And they do. And people pay to come and do that, and when they're done doing that, they like to get a bite to eat, or have a drink of beer, or a pop. Or when they're out of the water, they look around the canyon and they go, dang, I think I might like to climb them rocks, too. Wonder if they got any bicycles around here. And so we got rock climbing companies, and we got bicycle selling and renting companies, and we got people who lead hikes and tours and fishing expeditions on the part of the river that doesn't make you go whee-hoo, and a whole economy bloomed here, and it's multiple millions of dollars every year, and just when we think that it's going okay and it can expand and flourish and good things can happen, Consol Energy comes along and says, hold on, boys, we done found some more coal. We want to screw you some more, sweetie.
There's no future in that. You guys, you know, I know you're not going to allow it, so. But, yeah, we can't allow it. And, you know, the way that we, and I heard, what's his name, Van Jones, I heard him speak. He's, you know, you're right about him. You know, we have to stop raping, you know, there is rape. It's, there's not, I, when I, if, think of what they do, and there's the only other equivalent that I can think of, what they're doing to these mountains and the landscape and the environment, you know, just pollution. It's just rape. It is. And, you know, to sit there and stop that is, it's my responsibility to stop using coal.
Yeah, and let me just reiterate this. In addition, like I said, we were told time and again that congressional offices just love handwritten letters. And I say this particularly to you, Albert, not because I feel like I have to reiterate it to you, but because you're in a jurisdiction that all jurisdictions matter. But there's a wrinkle in Wisconsin, and that is that soon Senator Feingold is going to reintroduce something called the Clean Water Restoration Act. Okay, and it's a good bill. But it won't end mountaintop removal. It's a totally different animal. And we need to make sure that there is a clear distinction between the Clean Water Protection Act, which desperately needs to be introduced in the Senate, and the Clean Water Restoration Act. So it would be really neat if you and other Wisconsin listeners could drop a note to Herb Kohl and Russ Feingold and say, listen, thanks, it's great, you know, the Clean Water Restoration Act is going to be great, but you need to get some pressure out there to get somebody to introduce the Clean Water Protection Act, because they sound a little too similar, and there's no way Senator Feingold could or should introduce both. But we need to make sure that he is supportive of that concept as well. The idea that Appalachia needs mountaintop removal to end.
Oh, I'm sure. Actually, there's a meeting for this case, and I'm not sure if he's going to be there, but I'm thinking perhaps Kind is going to be there, because this is his jurisdiction, and he's going to want to hear it. I'll let him know, too.
There's a list out there. Check the list and see if he is a... already a co-sponsor of 1310.
Yeah, it wouldn't shy. I mean, this is Russ Feingold. He's one. You know, he's
no. I'm talking about Kind.
Kind. You know, no, Kind is. I'm not a big fan of him, but he has changed his stance on a number of issues that I brought up to him. The issue we were just talking about in terms of cannabis being one of them, slightly here and there. I've seen him change his years, but he's not. I don't know, he seems like he's always in the pocket of the corporations. He's one of those dinos, I fear. I hope not, but
it's not like there's not a bunch of them. Have you seen this business, Albert, about this super double secret probation gang of moderates in the Senate that Evan Bayh has put together? He doesn't want to let anybody know who it is, but he's got himself a bunch of moderates, and they're going to make sure that the liberals can't have their way.
Oh, Jesus.
And it's taken some doing, but we're finding out. And the thing is, there were some whose names were announced, but there are others let me find the language on it. Okay, right now, Bayh's moderate coalition includes Senator Tom Carper, Democrat of Delaware, Blanche Lincoln, Democrat of Arkansas, Mark Udall, Democrat of Colorado. He's a newbie, by the way. Michael Bennett, Democrat of Colorado, Mark Begich, Democrat of Alaska, Kay Hagan, she's a newbie. Remember, she's the one that got sleazed by Liddy Dole, and yet she still thinks she needs to be a moderate.
Yeah, I'm sitting here, I'm hearing you say these names, and I can remember, like, Blue America and MoveOn.org and all these other organizations that are, you know, MediaMan, like, all these, like, things, you know, all those sites and the, you know, we've supported them to get them.
Herb Kohl.
Kohl is a putz, I'm sorry.
Mary Landrieu.
Yeah, she's
Claire McCaskill.
Really?
Yeah. Ben Nelson of Nebraska, Bill Nelson of Florida, Gene Shaheen of New Hampshire, Mark Warner of Virginia, and of course, what group such as this would be complete without the inclusion of Joe Lieberman?
Yeah, I was going to I thought you were going to say him first, honestly, because
no, we leave the sleaze for last. But there are three senators that Evan Bayh described as going to his little group's meetings, but they didn't want to be publicly identified because they were ashamed, I guess. Evan Bayh says they're in what he calls the witness protection program. It is dismaying to me to see that Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota is one of those three. Mark Pryor of Arkansas is another one. That's no surprise. And Senator Robert P. Casey Jr. of Pennsylvania is another mugwump.
I think they're going to have to they're going to hear an earful from their constituents. They're going to start hearing it. You know, I mean, not for nothing. You know, we've been trying to consolidate all of our finances through actual credit organizations or programs that are run by banks but run through unions. And you know, not for nothing, it's actually kind of refreshing. I don't mind it at all. When we get our credit card statement in the mail, it says, "Where do you stand on healthcare for workers?" You know, and I'll tell you, you know, you see that, and you know, I just see it, and you know, I'm sure there are tons of other people starting to see it. And you know, man, we're going to want healthcare. These things that these moderates are going to stop. What are they trying to stop? They're going to try to stop healthcare? Well, they're going to get crushed. They're going to sit there and they're going to try to stop, you know, ending prohibition. Listen, they're going to get crushed because prohibition doesn't work, and we may have been in a daze since the 30s, you know, but it doesn't work. It cannot work. It's an impossibility. Hey, it doesn't work, period. You know, I mean, sitting there and keeping people and getting them bankrupt because of health care costs, that doesn't work. It's not sustainable. Building Hummers and toilets out of old growth trees, that's not sustainable. And as you know, and I know I ramble a bunch, but when I'm sitting here talking, you know, when the word sustainability, it's so deep. It's more.
Oh, yeah, Albert, you mentioned those old growth trees. You know what a cartoon freak I am.
Yes, sir.
There was an old one, and I can't remember. I want to think it's Warner Brothers, but it might have been an MGM. It certainly wasn't Disney. But it's a tour of industrial America, and there's this big fat mouse character, I think, who is basically a parody of W.C. Fields, because he keeps telling this little mouse, "Get away from me, kid! You bother me." And he's leading this tour of industrial America, and there's this one scene where they show huge logs going into a factory. And they get bolted onto, I guess, what you'd consider some sort of giant animated lathe. And you get the sound effect. And out comes a toothpick. And, you know, then the robotic arm picks up the toothpick and drops it in the box of toothpicks.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where we are. And that's a 60-year-old cartoon.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you know it. When you're talking about, you know, such things, people have known, you know, but back in the day when, you know, people couldn't communicate as quickly. This is back in during Prohibition. When those things started, you know, nobody knew what marijuana was. They didn't know what it was because there was the Mexican slang term for it.
Yeah, because they had to invent a word.
Exactly. I mean, like, the whole thing of getting that crap illegal, you know, from black men stepping on white men's shadows or looking at white women or the other racist crap that they tried to get that spawned with is, you know, even it pales in comparison to the fact that they called it something that nobody knew it by. And then by the time the doctors who prescribed, I mean, one-third of all medications was this plant, was its extracts, one-third of all medications. in it. Yeah, I know they did cocaine too, but you know what? I have a can of Ambisol right here on my maximum strength when I had a toothache. And let me tell you, what's the active ingredient? Oh, cane. This is cocaine. You know, like people go, oh, look at the nostalgia of cocaine mouth lozenges. Well, you still got it and you can still buy it. It's just in a gel that tastes like bubblegum now. But you know, it's like, you know, it doesn't mean it's cocaine, but it's.
Yeah, that reminds me of the cherry flavored OxyContin lollipops that came out a few years ago. Remember those? No, really, they were sustained OxyContin delivery systems in a cherry lollipop form, and attorneys general around the country saw it and went, oh no, just stop. It ain't like we don't have a problem in the first place.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, talk about taking candy from a baby. Jesus. Who's that, talk about the people who earn the money. Who's the genius that sits at Big Pharma?
Yeah.
And says, you know what nobody else has got, boss? Nobody else has an OxyContin lollipop yet. We need to make some OxyContin lollipops.
Yeah. You know, not for
next
nothing,
up, right? Demerol ice cream. I don't know.
See, but they're here, true. But, you know, not for nothing. I could see that having, that could have a purpose. One of
sure it could.
But you shouldn't market it. It should be marketed thing.
But in America, you can't have a drug that you don't market.
Yeah, and that's sick.
May cause your nose to slide off. Ask your doctor today.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. Have people, I mean, you know, like, I think people have had enough in terms of the financial Armageddons and the ecological Armageddons. And, you know, what about these pharmacological, just, they're drug dealers. These people are drug dealers of, and they're selling bad drugs that kill people, like, just insane.
Yeah, but yet, Albert, you know what, Albert, you will never hear. You will never read a news story, no matter how bad the economy gets. You will never read a news story that says pharmaceutical industries declare economy so bad they can no longer afford to advertise. Now, they may quit making some orphan drugs that, you know, would save one person in a thousand.
Yeah.
They may quit marketing some less profitable drugs that are now available as generics. But they will never be too broke to advertise.
Yeah. You know, not for nothing.
Ask your doctor if poops a lot is right for you.
Yeah, seriously. That's the other thing. You know, and this kind of slides right back into the KFO, because I want to talk about the drug industry. One of the things that they do, everybody knows this. Do you feel down? Do you feel itchy? Do you feel scratchy? This is what you need. You know, go ask your doctor, all this other stuff, which does blow buttons of people in other countries where they don't, you know, these pharmaceutical companies can't directly advertise to you. One of the things that they do is, that they're the ones that make and sell and market the antibiotics to these KFOs. And they make these broad-spectrum antibiotics and then give them out to populace, give them out to cattle, put them into such a way that they create these bugs. You see, like, I think people, I hope, that they're starting to see all the damage that, Celebrex and this one and that one and Zoloft makes you crazy and all these other things that people have, started to say, whoa, wait, why do we have all this stuff? Now I hope they start looking at it in a different way of how it damages us in terms of creating these Mercer superbugs, these bugs that there are no antibiotics for because all the antibiotics we have been used against them and in not the correct way, not the proper dosage, and now they're immune to it. And now we have no defense against, flesh-eating, zombie-creating bacteria, which might be a fun time as long as you don't get infected, but, That's a whole other ball game, but yeah, true. If we're going to put restrictions on financial illusion, jugglers, right? And we certainly should. There should be a limit to the illusion that they can, conjure up. Then we start falling into it and think it's too real. We should also put some massive restrictions on these people that can create, literally, by accident or by greed or however they're doing it, can create a super bug that could kill us all. And kill everything. I mean, we could create a, you know, you know, you who the hell knows? You know, rabies, all immune to all this because all the cows drinking, you know, antibiotics, and then it's just stupid. It's just dumb. It's just stupid stuff for people to make money now. You know, who the hell cares what happens in 6 years? We're making money now, which I don't see that as any kind of. That's just not a mindset that I don't think anybody who hears that or recognizes and sees that that's where we are. I don't think that anybody swallows that and says, yeah, that's where we need to be. I don't even think maybe the freaks believe it, but nobody that's a person that really truly loves and cares about things and cares about and thinks about the future. Nobody wants to see that kind of crap. I don't care. The only people that say that are the people that are paid to say that.
There you go.
I don't know, brother. All right.
Hey, Albert, great fun tonight, man.
Always, brother, always. You take care and keep them safe.
Going to try. Talk to you later.
Always.
Bye now.
Bye-bye, brother.
Brother Albert calling from rural Wisconsin. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Hey, what's up?
Well, I just wanted to say... I was the first person to mention Idiocracy on this program.
Yes, you were.
Taking the royalties on that one.
Yes, you do. You deserve it.
Actually, I wanted to bring this up because I'm going to go ahead of the curve and I'm going to predict another one for you. Another community film or iconic film. If everything fires on all cylinders, and I mentioned it before on this program before, but I want to mention it to you again because I want to highlight it this time so you'll know when it's coming and you'll be completely ahead.
Big, broad, bright, flashing lights.
So a lot of people are preparing for Kevin Smith's next film, which is called Red State. And for those people who don't know, Red State is going to be a horror film. It's going to be 2% humor, and it's about what happens when fundamentalism goes wrong in America and it doesn't have a happy ending, people. I'll give you one example of how much people have just they've just dropped their jaw when they've read the script of Kevin. One of his friends in an IM, he said, "I'm going to give you the script to read over it." So he sent it in his email, and his only response to Kevin was, "I dare you." So that's a film for people to look out for, Red State. It's probably going to come around fall 2010. They're looking for a distributor. He's probably going to get a distributor. Miramax is probably not going to pick it up because it is going to be that kind of controversy. It was inspired by Fred Phelps, and this is Kevin Smith's ode to what he's seeing, what's happening primarily in Middle America. So look out for it, people. Red State.
Cool. And you will remind us again when it gets nearer.
Yes, I will remind you. And then the other film that people are really getting crazy over is a film called The Road, which is the author of McCormick, who did No Country for Old Men. And The Road is about a dystopia future of what happens when all you have left is just survivalism, thieves, and... thieves, scoundrels, and just people trying to live on the land, survivalists. And it's pretty interesting. Michael K. Williams is in it, and a lot of other people. So that's another film. There's no release date on that, but that one will be more interesting than that crap fest that's coming down the pike 2012. that movie is going to be like Armageddon. But that's not what.
Oh, wait, David, you've got a challenge.
Oh yes.
News Ninja Gene just chimed in and said, "I called it first."
You called it first? I don't think so. I mean, when you go back to it.
Oh wait. Maybe he's talking about The Road or Red State.
Red State? You go back months and months. I've been on the Kevin Smith board, so.
Okay.
I don't think you want to challenge me on that one. I mean, I was when it
well,
was
you guys can duke it out in a horn chat room steel cage death match. Okay.
I just want to say something about the fate of liberal talk, and this will pretty much people will know. But as soon as I say this, Tom Hartman is plugging for Hummer now.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not. And someone brought it up, and even Tom Hartman had to, you know, wince and say, "Don't you think this is kind of hypocritical?" And he couldn't get out of it. He does the gold commercials, but you know, when you, I think that's the sign when you know that radio advertisers and especially liberal shows are in a crunch for money. When you have to advertise for Hummer, that's just something for people to think about.
Well, look, you know, he just went over, and I like Tom. Okay, I respect
I
Tom.
I listen to him every day.
So I don't want to be. This is not some slur or some slam. It is sincerely not that.
Yeah.
But let me just say that this is not the nature of that's not the nature of Tom Hartman. That's the nature of terrestrial radio, because terrestrial liberal talk is still operating on the same advertising paradigm as right-wing radio. Right-wing radio is funded on ads for vacuum cleaners that pick up bowling balls, Swedish mattresses, and herbal hair growth remedies, and buy gold, and incorporate in Nevada, and I guess Hummer. And so it's not that, you know, there wasn't some staff meeting where Tom was sitting around with a bunch of other people and said, you know what, Tom, you know, and Tom says, you know what I want to do? I want to get out there and shill for Hummer. No, they came to him and said, Tom, we're paying you a crap load of money. Now you're going to shill for Hummer. And
yeah,
that's one of those moments where it's the parable of the poop sandwich. You know, you're going to eat some poop. The question is whether there's enough bread to cover up the taste.
So one thing that I wanted to mention also was...
And a nice living and being able to pay your bills will make shilling for Hummer a lot less unsavory.
Well, you know, one of the outrages that a lot of people aren't picking up on is, I guess the Obama administration has handed $70 million to Blackwater.
Oh, no.
For those already outraged, this is according to Jeremy Scahill on Alternet. For those already outraged at the IAG bonus scandal, here's a fact that should add more fuel to the fire. The Obama administration has paid the mercenary firm, formerly known as Blackwater, nearly $70 million to operate in Iraq, and according to Washington Times, may keep the company on the payroll months past the official expiration of its Iraq contract in May. I reviewed Blackwater's recent transactions with the Obama State Department and discovered a $45 million payment to Blackwater on February 4th, 2009, for protective services Iraq. It is described as a funding action only. Here is the interesting part. The estimated ultimate completion date is May 7th, 2011.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
And that kind of ties into what I wanted to talk about regarding the Obama administration. I mean, if they do this, and doesn't that technically make them unconstitutional light just by doing that?
I don't know that it does. I will not begin to offer an excuse or an apologia for it, David.
It's like what you were talking about, the poop sandwich. There has to be, I would imagine that there has to be some political strategy here. Some sense of logic that they didn't want any firestorm from these security companies. They didn't want any follow-up.
Or maybe if they've got a contract with them, then they've still got them on the government dole. Therefore, they've still got them on the government hook and can bust them. There's hopeful ways of looking at something like that. Some of this is that ancient principle of using the greater weight of your opponent against your opponent.
It is kind of sad when you think about the fact that people still want to consider Blackwater, which it isn't Blackwater anymore. It's Z right now. That's what it's renamed now.
Right. Z.
Did
they give up the bear claw too?
They shouldn't. I mean, they should keep the bear claw and the parachutes and and parachuting into the. I saw the training film. If anyone's ever seen the training film, that's some insane crap right there.
Yeah, those are some crazy bastards. We can say
one
that
last
here.
Thing.
Because they're not advertising with us.
Yeah. One last thing before I close out for the night. Regarding the Leno appearance tonight, what are your thoughts on that? And do you think it's a great idea?
Well, Leno's such a little right-wing shitheel. Sorry. I would far prefer it had been Letterman. I don't think it'll hurt him. I won't tune in. I don't necessarily know why he's going. Maybe they can go in and yuck it up about AIG. I frankly, I don't know. I don't get it. Maybe it's the Obama mind trick, and these are not the bonuses you're looking for. And America goes, no, these are not the bonuses we're looking for. That's a funny joke.
It ties into Idiocracy, because when you're talking about when you're talking about the financial crisis and an economic meltdown, you're going to need an applause meter for that.
Could be. In terms of who wants which? And yeah.
No, I mean, I just think in terms of that, that's where we've come to. I mean, nobody's going to turn on to see Obama on the nightly news, and he knows that. No one's going to turn to see Obama on...
Then if he wants to do this, then for the love of God, go on The Daily Show.
Yeah, I think the problem with that is the fact that he sees it as it's painted with such a satirical brush. Now the fact that he's in office, he doesn't want to be treated like he wants. I mean, with Leno, at least it's
some of this is a matter of drawing a bright line distinction between him and Bush. There's no way that George Bush could have survived on air with any comedian. Okay, sooner or later it would have been a disaster.
Al Gore made the right call when he went on Letterman.
Yeah,
he didn't go on Leno. I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
Does that
say something about Obama's humor as well?
I don't think so, David. I think more in terms of of who the demographic is. In descending order. The hippest, coolest audience and the youngest audience is clearly John Stewart's.
Yeah.
Then comes maybe Conan O'Brien, and then comes Letterman. And I'm not saying Conan's humor is better than Letterman's. Letterman's is the best humor overall. My God. The other night when Julia Roberts, it was another. See, I enjoyed the luxury of just sitting there going click, click, click in the hotel room, and saw 15 seconds of a lot of stuff, and I just happened to click past Letterman when Julia Roberts, beautiful Julia Roberts, was getting ready to repeat a dirty word in telling a story about a director. Okay, and she looks at Letterman and says, "If I say this, will you bleep me?" And there was that perfect 2 second comic beat, beat, two count.
Yeah.
And Letterman just deadpans the camera and says, "Well, good night, folks." On national television, no less. And suddenly Julia Roberts realizes what she's just said. "Will you bleep me?" And it just descended into marvelous chaos. But anyway, what I was getting at. If you want the edgy crowd, I think you clearly go to Stewart or Letterman. But Leno is somebody that the so-called red state America is comfortable with, because he makes a lot of them Bill Clinton jokes. And that Bill Clinton, that dirty son bitch. You know, we can still make jokes about him. It's really low brow, doesn't take any work kind of humor. Because the Leno audience and the Letterman audience are wildly different creatures.
Oh, I agree with you. I think someone needs to slip some Bill Hicks into Obama's iPod.
I'd be surprised if Obama had never heard him.
In an atmosphere like that, I would say, like, where a lot of people who really are on the edge of cool, there is that of the city types in the metropolis areas where they don't know Bill Hicks. They just know the standard realm of comedians. Which isn't saying it's bad. It's just, you know, Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy, you know, George Carlin. For some reason, you know, there was that.
Now, but see,
he was right on that.
Bill frame. Hicks was a philosopher, masquerading
yeah,
as a comedian.
Yeah, he was a philosopher and a comedian, and he went on. That's another reason why I don't really. I kind of second guessed at Letterman when he did that thing with over Bill Hicks.
Well,
regarding his performance.
Yeah, but replaying that, I think, was really rather cool because there was something absolutely wonderful about hearing Bill Hicks from the grave saying, I'm starting a new reality television show called Let's Hunt and Kill Billy Ray Cyrus. Because, you know, if he had, we wouldn't be watching Hannah Montana now.
That's pretty ahead of its time because reality shows were...
not born yet.
The only one going on at that time was Real World.
Yeah, not born yet, really.
And
yeah.
Survivor was kind of like the official one out the gate.
Yeah. So,
but,
you know, no, so I think it's strictly a demographic choice.
Hmm.
And
I'm gonna watch it to see what happens. I'm sure everyone else here is gonna watch it as well.
Then you can all email me and tell me.
Well, you know, Bob, the perfect set to open it up. It's going to be on the forum.
There you go.
RadioNetwork.com/forum. Sure. I haven't posted anything for a day or so, but that's going to change. I'm going to have a slew of articles, including all the stuff on archaeology, science, music, the latest things with technology. I've been listing up a storm. I've actually been delving into history, Bob. I've been listing a lot of cabinet cards and photos from, you know, over 100 years ago.
Oh, wow.
A lot of interesting, you know, it's interesting to look at a lot of these photos and how they took pictures back then, like with the sepia tones, the selenium.
Yeah.
Selenium? With the CDVs, which is where they would use props to hold the people up. Sometimes, Bob, you can even see errors in the photos I think I have an error photo actually of a girl sitting down and it's like there's a wire in back of her damn neck, a little girl. it's like
ew.
Still, honey, I know, but I mean that's you know they want, it's like they really,
well, maybe that's
to
how they taught them to sit and stand up straight back in the day.
Yeah, but you know, America. And I guess for a big part of us is it goes back to that what the neocons said about creating our own reality. We really want to create our own history. And regarding the issue of Iraq, I really hope go the route of what we normally do, and we really hold stand to our principles and our beliefs. And at least our convictions in the fact that it's okay to criticize your country, and it's okay to realize that you're a part of that. But, I mean, it makes you a stronger person, and it makes you have a stronger country if you keep talking about these issues. And, you know, I think people get stuck on the fact that, well, it's not doing anything. It's not doing anything. Yes, it is. You're instilling it in your family, and you're instilling it in the people around you. Maybe the culture is not going to change, but your family and the people around you, you're going to carry on your beliefs, your morals, and your values of what you believe in, to be logic and common sense. And if you're a peaceful person, I don't see any loss there, people.
Yeah. Well, I think, yeah, why not? Sure, you're right. So
no, I mean, what I'm basically saying, Bob, is I'm basically saying that...
No, I understand what... Yeah.
I mean, people get so caught up in what the majority of the people do. Just concerned about yourself and your circle. You know what you're doing, Bob, regarding the coal issue and regarding how your family is growing? That's going to influence other generations of people. You know the problem is the problem is we're so selfish. I want to see it. Well, guess what? We probably won't see it.
And that's the cool thing about the stuff that I'm involved in. We want it ended the sooner the better. Yesterday should never have happened, you know. But every single person in the organizations that I'm involved with, every single person understands it may not happen in their lifetime. Because every single person involved in this fight understands that we are fighting in a toxic environment, and God knows when the other shoe is going to drop, and the doctor goes, well, you've got, and we realize that we just got the cancel Christmas letter. But the fight goes on for a generation yet unborn, because we can't fix what's wrong until we stop what's being done. Because
you might want to give out the number. To call before you close out the program so people can hear it and write it down. I think that's another thing. I guess with these issues, I guess we just have to plug more. And that's why sometimes we all have to stop what we're talking about and talk about this important issue and plug it, because it really does matter. Promotion does matter. I don't stop in trafficking. What I'm selling and what I'm promoting, it adds up. It's momentum. So that's what
it's
I was
cumulative.
Calling in.
Yes, exactly.
It's cumulative. And I think.
And you know, I mentioned it to Albert. We particularly need your particular help, David, because if we're going to get the Clean Water Protection Act, for instance, introduced in the Senate and passed by the Senate in order to make this a law to end this, what's going on here, mm-hmm. we're going to need some Republicans. And you're sitting on top of two of them that we need.
Yeah, I know.
And these people, I reiterate, you know, they read their emails, they take down their phone messages, yada, 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 but they absolutely get all hot and bothered over handwritten letters. If you've got 10 minutes out of your life to write down a letter to Olympia Snow and Susan Collins and tell them you want a companion bill to H.R. 1310, the Clean Water Protection Act, and that you want it introduced and passed in the Senate, and that you damned well expect that they will not only support but will advocate for it, it will mean something. If you can find four or five other people in Maine who will do this, David, it will mean even more.
I'll see what I can do regarding that. Now, it has to be handwritten. It can't be typed.
Well, no, they want a letter from home. No, it can be typed.
I was going to say.
But the whole idea is that it's in an envelope. It's got an address on it. It's got a stamp. It makes it through. It's a tangible, physical thing that they can't get away from. That's why Robert Byrd made that big deal about how he got letters from constituents with little coffee cup rings and donut sugar stains on them, telling them we wanted that West Virginians wanted Samuel Alito to be on the court, and that's why he decided to support him.
How much time we have on a bill like this regarding...
Well, I mean, this is the 111th Congress, and it'll go for 2 years. It may take, you know what, it may take the rest of the year to even get it introduced in the Senate. Right now, we've got, you know, 130 or so co-sponsors and climbing in the House. We've almost got enough to get it out of committee. But it is not even introduced in the Senate, and passing a bill in the Senate is a wildly more difficult task than getting something through the House. And that's not to in any way minimize what's been the work that's been done on the House side. But the Senate side is mountain climbing.
Well, I'll tell you what, Bob. I know you got to run. I don't usually write letters. I don't usually type letters. I don't believe in it. But if you say this, and you say it's drastic, then you got me on board, and I'll put something together. And next week, that will be out there. I'll get my mom and some other family members to do the same thing.
Bless your heart, David. You know, I'm just repeating what was said to us by a whole bunch of Hill staffers. We like letters from home. And if it's coming, you know, it has twice as much weight if it's coming from an actual constituent. You know, that's why, you know, And that's part of a strategy that has to be worked up somewhere down the road. We've got to get into the several states and get people writing those letters, and that's what I'm trying to do right here. David, it's been a great conversation, and thank you for helping out. Thank you for everything you do with the forum and the pulse you keep on popular culture. By the way, News Ninja Gene says he was referring to the road.
Oh, okay. No problem. I just want to say, the bill, support H.R. 1310, that's the bill?
Yeah, we need a companion bill in the United States Senate to H.R. 1310. The Clean
people,
Water Protection Act.
Okay, people, you just heard it. I'm sold on it. So that means you should get on it right now as well, and I hope I'll tell you what, Bob. By the time next week I'll read it off the air of what I decided to send to my Senator Collins and.
Beautiful, David. Beautiful.
And
thanks so much.
That'll inspire people.
Exactly. That's the whole point. You know, this is activist radio. And that's activism.
And one more thing, I think you should read that article tomorrow. I'm begging you to actually do it. What Mike Malloy read on the Robert Freeman Weimar Republic article on Common Dreams.
Absolutely, I will go do that.
And please, and I think it would inspire a lot of people to hear it on the radio as well. I know it's a little bit long, but it's really necessary for people to hear it.
Okay, can do. That'd be a good good Friday topic. Take care, David.
All right, later.
Bye now. Pop culture correspondent David calling from Maine. I hope this line's still here. Hey, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I'm still here.
Hey, Preston.
You know, sometimes I'm on hold for a while because this, I was getting some pretty big phone bill. And I know if I call in on 800 numbers, some people will assume that 800 number. It's not toll free, and so all on my own dime. But
Preston, you're kind of breaking up. I hate to say it. Okay. Is there anything you can do on your end to make things behave a little bit better?
I doubt it. Try calling again.
Is this like a Skype line or something, or?
That's my computer and all that.
Is there anything eating up your bandwidth on, because it's real choppy, and we got a big pipe here.
Boy, I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll take a few minutes, with Ben Birch's kind indulgence. I'll take a few minutes of extra innings here. And you know, don't be afraid to use the toll free line, my friend. We'll close this connection and turn around and dial right back, and I'll get you right back on. Okay.
Sounds good.
All right. Thank you, Preston.
I'll do that.
Okay.
Do that.
Yeah. Listen, when I say save us a nickel or a buck, that doesn't mean don't use the toll free line. I try to get to calls as fast as I possibly can. And you know, the fact that we do conversation radio here means that sometimes, you know, sometimes it's my fault when I run up our own toll-free bill, but it's a bill we gladly pay as long as we have the wherewithal with which to pay it. Okay, so if that's how you need to get through that way. Okay, please? Because I don't want you guys running up your bills either. That's why we always say, if you have an unlimited long-distance dialing plan or something along those lines, if you have minutes to spare, then use that direct dial number. But if you need to use the toll-free number, for heaven's sakes, don't let that hold you back for an instant from dialing in and sharing in the conversation, okay? Seriously. Is that you, Preston?
Yes, it is.
Ah, and much better at that.
Oh, good. Glad to hear it. I don't know what was up with that, but... Anyway, I was saying I drop off the line sometimes because, you know, I just would rather send you the money instead of the phone company. Although I go through a great phone company, that Working Assets, long distance.
That is a good company. You know, I've looked, there's another good one out there for cell service called Credo.
You know, that's the same. They just changed their name to Credo, actually.
Oh, okay. And I've actually called them and said, guys, please, you know, if you'd get service in my area, I'd go to you. So, but yeah. they haven't found a way to get liberal activist oriented cell service into the hills and hollers of West Virginia yet. And there's probably a good reason for that, because people as liberal as me here are kind of hard to find.
And I have some friends who really like what they're up to, but you know, their plans just don't quite fit for them. They make a lot of international calls or something, and it just turns out to be prohibitively expensive for them. So, but yeah, they're doing good work. You know, for your listeners who may not know about them, they're one of those companies that send some of their profits to progressive organizations, Amnesty and Rainforest Action, all kinds of good groups. And over the past,
we love RAN.
Yeah,
they've been really, really good on the mountaintop removal issue.
In fact, come to think of it, you know, some of us may want to drop them a line and nominate, you know, Coal River Mountain Watch to receive one of their grants. I know I was working with the East Timor Action Network, and we started lobbying them to include them, and I thought shot that it worked out, and they received money from working assets for a couple of years.
Well, I'll be honest, and this is just me being shamelessly just my shameless desire to keep everything going here. I'd love to see some other organizations besides Coal River Mountain Watch step up and help keep the horn going. RAN is one of them. Sierra Club, NRDC. Because the I don't know how much you listen to Malloy, but I caught him giving the master class the other night on funding of liberal radio, and you know he's in a place that I've been in for going on 4 years now, and that is trying to make bricks without straw, and that's not to denigrate all the hard work and all the kind contributions that have come in from listeners. That's not the point. It is the point is that if liberal organizations are really as liberal as they say they are, Preston, I should never have to ask a single solitary listener to this network to give up so much as one thin dime.
You're right. It's ridiculous that you do not have money pouring into you from groups like that. It's ridiculous. I think it was Elaine who talked about this maddening missing links that we have going on here between groups with shared goals.
And and bear in mind, that's not to say that I've been turned down by any of these groups I mentioned. I haven't asked yet. But that's a function of, you know, do I do that in hour 25 or hour 26 of my day?
Right. And, I think a lot of people are already aware of you. I mean, Mike's been cool enough to mention your program on his show.
Mike has been as dear a friend as this network has in terms of just letting people know that we exist and letting people know that he thinks what we do is valid and viable. And he's a hero to me.
Where is Mike now? I mean, I went to the Nova M.
If you want to catch Mike now, go to MikeMalloy.com. He and Kathy are doing everything on their own now. He's getting his feed out to the satellite providers and his terrestrial radio affiliates and everything straight out of their studios. But if you go to MikeMalloy.com, there is a link that is of a stream that's maintained by Ben Birch. The guy who saved and is still saving liberal talk on the internet. WhiteRoseSociety.org. There's a link to the stream that Ben has built for Mike's program, and it's there every night.
Great.
And that's
thank you, Ben.
Yeah, MikeMalloy.com, MikeMalloy.com.
Okay. Yeah, because Nova M disappeared. I guess the finance situation maybe.
I don't know if the true story of what happened with Nova M will ever be told.
That's true. Who knows what?
But I'm not saying that the false story has been told, but there's just stuff out there that, because we live in a litigious world, can't be said.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought you worded it quite well regarding speaking of funding radio and the gold ads and the Hummer ads that, you know, sadly Tom Hartman feels compelled to do when you said that.
No, he doesn't feel compelled. He is compelled.
Yeah.
The guy who signs his check has come to him and said, now it's time to shill Hummers.
Yeah.
Because we've got a Hummer shilling contract.
Yeah. So, yeah, and it's not Tom's nature, but it's the nature, you know, terrestrial radio as it's structured.
Right, because nobody out there, I mean, theoretically at least, Preston, this model brings in millions and millions of dollars for the right wing.
Yeah.
And you know, there's that old, it's that sort of herd-like tendency of the human species to see something working for one group of people and assume that it will work universally. I personally don't think it will. But then again, you got to go out there and find those businesses who are not afraid of having having forthright, straightforward opinion delivered. Because the right wing, Preston, is very, very good, and they've proven it over and over again, at absolutely flooding companies with calls of doing to companies what ought to be done, for instance, to Rush Limbaugh, of flooding companies with calls and saying, as long as you're doing business with them, we won't do business with you. And corporate America, if it's a liberal, goes, ah!
Yeah, you know, but there are certain industries that have got so much money that they can provide sort of a corporate independence, independence from popular opinion, to carry on with this
exactly
elitist, destructive messaging.
Exactly. On the other hand, why aren't, and any time that I ask these why aren't questions, I'm speaking generally, Preston, because I am not a radio sales guy. I'm a radio behind the mic guy. By dint of necessity, I've become a radio arms inside the computer guy and a radio crawling under the desk and wrecking my knees looking for stray wires guy. I'm not a radio sales or marketing guy. But by extension of the same logic you just put forward, why, for instance, aren't the huge industrial wind companies advertising all over liberal radio and helping make liberal radio, which in turn advances causes that are near and dear to their bottom line, why aren't they spending money there? Because, I mean, do you remember, did you ever watch, like, the CBS Morning News or any of the Today Show or something, and you'll see, brought to you by Archer Daniels Midland, supermarket to the world. When's the last time, Preston, you bought a can of Archer Daniels Midland creamed corn?
I try to avoid it.
Well, in this case, you don't have to, because they don't make it. Nobody who's watching the CBS Morning News can buy anything from Archer Daniels Midland.
Well,
they're merely putting their name out there and making themselves ubiquitous.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was thinking I probably get it via some corn syrup.
Oh, yeah, you get it. Yeah, you get it indirectly, sure. High fructose corn syrup, you know, dead pancreas brand corn syrup, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you're right. You know, they do a lot of advertising on NPR, you know, public radio, and that's an audience that is aware of some of the issues with agribusiness. I mean, that's an audience that shops at a Whole Foods or a Wild Oats.
Right, but guess what?
They're learning.
Exactly, but guess what happens when they put that on NPR, Preston?
Then NPR is less apt to talk about the issues of GMOs. And
it's even more subtle than that. This is an NPR audience. This is, as you that's an NPR audience, an audience, as you said, that is educated and up and understands what these, you know, what the Monsantos and so forth of the world are doing. But this program is brought to you by a generous contribution from Great Big Corporation of America, poisoning America one community at a time. Now, classical music today. And you're thinking, well, you know, they're poisoning America one community at a time, but hey, they're sponsoring the classical music on NPR that I just love. Maybe I ought to give them a second chance.
Yeah, yep, yep. They're buying obedience of a sort. Yeah.
Or at least no, it's, I wouldn't say obedience so much as it is, at the most, complicity, and at the least, silence.
Yeah.
You know, silence is important. You know, if you're getting ready to fire off a letter to your congressman and say, you know, I really hate what they're, you know, what Monsanto is doing to America, and then you suddenly think, but then they may not be able to afford to sponsor my evening's hour of ukulele music every Sunday, and you go, zip, yeah, and no letter.
Right. Right. I agree.
But I wanted to, I'm so glad you called. I wanted to raise an issue with you, if I may.
Please. Yeah.
And it's similar to what I was talking about with David a few minutes ago.
Okay.
Because you're in a jurisdiction we need too, Preston.
In a jurisdiction that's been kind of shameful over the past couple days with Udall and Bennett joining this moderate Democratic whatever.
There you go.
Yep.
Now, but it becomes even more interesting because Udall was a sponsor of the Clean Water Protection Act in the 110th when he was still a member of the House.
Real quickly, back on the free speech issue and
yeah.
complicity, I wanted to mention a book called Speechless, which is about, and there's a subtitle to that. If you look it up, some other books will come up, but it's called Speechless, and it's about the lack of free speech in the workplace in this country and the way they've focused our minds, some people's minds, on the Second Amendment while the First Amendment has been crushed for so many people who are afraid to speak out, write a letter to an editor. God, they would never call into a talk radio show for fear that someone will hear it and they'll lose their job. I mean, the silence here in the land of the is, you know, the financial pressures that a lot of people feel that need to be overcome. But anyway.
Well, it's I'm glad to hear that, Preston, because I love it. This is what little bit of ego I do bring to bear on the program. I do love it, Preston, when I hear something that tells me that I've been saying something for a while that has suddenly popped onto the into the attention of other people, because it's way more than a year, probably more than two, that I have been arguing that the First Amendment has been reduced to little more than a life support system for the religion industry. The First Amendment, where it concerns free speech, where it concerns rights of assembly. Where it concerns real freedom of the press, where it concerns real freedom of speech, all of that, all of those things have found, the courts have found a way to curtail. But where religion is concerned, not so much. You move on to the Second Amendment, and we've actually gone into retrograde motion when you think about the D.C. weapons ban.
Yep, and the bans that, you know, countries in the global south try to put up. You know, these African nations are like, we really don't need your high-powered rifles, thank you very much. And, boy, the NRA, they're all over that. They steamroll those regulations in the name of free trade, you know.
Right,
they have
right,
regulations,
right.
So they pour their guns into these countries. The NRA is very much an international movement as well. It's not just a local thing going on. They parlay their membership money and all that jazz.
I was driving out of Washington, D.C., headed west on Interstate 66, and I looked off to my left just on odd, you know, little synchronistic moment or whatever. Looked off to my left and went, son of a. And there it was, this tower that said at the top, in the corner, facing the interstate, NRA, National Rifle Association.
Mm-hmm.
Between membership dues over the years and a whole lot more, humongous grants of wealth from gun manufacturers, they've got this massive building out in the burbs of D.C.
from which emanates untold evil.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, there's a lot, so many ways they work that issue, and they fetishize guns, and there's a book called Gun Show Nation about it, and, you know, they put out this thought meme about people are really going out and buying guns now that Obama's president. People are really lit up. And, you know, there's probably some truth, probably was a spike in gun sales. But when, you know, their audience hears that, they're like, ooh, I better go out and get some more guns. And they see it as really a struggle for freedom.
Did I see something the other day, Preston, to the effect that they've run out of ammo to sell in Oklahoma?
Okay.
They can't keep bullets on the shelf in Oklahoma because everybody's convinced that, you know, we're going to have to get our single-shot deer rifles and go out there and beat them people that's got helicopters and howitzers and jets and tanks.
Yeah. You know, it's so pathetic, too, what some of these people do to shoot the guns. I mean, I have no problem if people want to shoot clay pigeons or even hunt with them. Well, fine. But these people, like, go out and it's called varmint hunting, and they just obliterate as many prairie dogs as they can.
Oh, that's sick.
It is. It is. They're doing to prairie dogs what was done with buffalo in an earlier period. Just mindless slaughter, no respect for the species.
And there's not that many in the way of prairie dogs to get left, are there?
They're declining rapidly. And they always have a pretext, a rationale for what they're doing. You know, well, they make the cows break their legs because they step in their holes.
Nah, see, that's not an urban myth. That's a rural myth. I mean, because I was told that, too, and then somebody wised me up and said, everybody says it, but I ain't never treated a cow with a broke ankle from a groundhog hole or a prairie dog hole.
Exactly. The people who really know that's a mythology. In fact, they know that the prairie dogs are actually vital to the ecosystems, and the cows kind of like going over to their communities because the prairie dogs have this role where they chew up the grass, aerate it, and make it better for the cows than
yes.
to eat the grass themselves. There's this beautiful system that they've got that they're a part of. And, just being mindlessly destroyed. But the prairie dogs, bless their hearts, they're so ingenious. They, people have studied their barks, their squeaks that they do. And apparently they've got a squeak that they'll send out to each other when they see a human being. Then they've got another squeak they'll do when they see a human being with a gun.
But they're dumb animals.
right.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of throws that whole idea of taking dominion over the earth into real disrepute, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But the whole natural world does that. You know, you mentioned the word varmint. Technically, there's an open season. The season was opened on wolves in Alaska. You know, the Godzilla from Wasilla did that.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you deem a particular life form is not worth having on the planet. And then you offer a bounty on the left foreleg of the animal, and you wind up with helicopters flying around Alaska with chunks of wolf on them. You know, shimminy.
Yeah.
You know, there are instances in which it is viable. For instance, when you know that a species has a high incidence of rabies, you want that species not to be around human dwelling places. When you know that, well, for instance, the stupidity that's gone on in this state, we've allowed the deer population to get so big, the DNR decided it would be a good idea to thin it. So guess what we've got now? Coyotes.
Mm-hmm.
Only the coyotes being coyotes, respond to pressure by having larger litters. So now we're in this goofy spiral of trying to get rid of the coyotes because we brought the coyotes in to get rid of the deer. It's just nuts.
It is. It, you know, I think a year or two ago was the 50th anniversary of Silent Spring. I think.
Yes, Rachel Carson.
Classic book. And the PR industry of the chemical, Dow Chemical and DuPont, all of them went after her legacy. And
she's been totally discredited.
That right. And then they blamed her for killing thousands of, you know, countless Africans because she got the use of DDT stopped. And she went on, they'd go, well, see, now there are all these mosquitoes and there's malaria and so on. They leave out the context, you know, of how the predator species were wiped out. They leave out the options of pesticides and herbicides. Like in Latin America, they've done a really comparatively great job controlling malaria through other approaches regarding standing water, regarding, you know, not wiping out amphibian species that eat the mosquito larvae and keeping fish in ponds and stuff like that. No, leave all that out. Just focus on your product. DDT works wonders. How dare Rachel Carson stop us from using it, even though it was, you know, destroying other species and causing cancers and so forth. So there's an interesting PR effort there against Rachel Carson. But ultimately, though, her work, she wins out. You know, she gets a lot of, you know, shots taken at her, and some people are susceptible, you know, to that public relations effort. But still, her legacy continues, and so many authors have picked up her torch and have continued her work.
Yeah, and it's so telling on the industry when the only way they can win is to debate a dead woman.
Right. That's right. And there's so, and you know, beyond the books and the authors who are carrying on her work, there are people who are demanding organics and who are planting their own organic gardens and who are learning about, you know, if you've got a bug problem, what other flower plant to, you know, deter some bugs and attract helpful bugs.
Marigolds.
Yep. You know, there's something like a, you know, just millions and millions of bug species, and only, you know, a small percentage of them can potentially cause problems. Usually they're so beneficial and, you know, critical to feeding these other species and to pollination. And there's actually a book called The War on Bugs. And it's really raised my consciousness about this other war going on that, you know, we just kind of...
Oh, yeah, and of course, there is the ubiquitous, much-despised potato bug. And they are. They're nasty-looking little creatures, and they make you crazy when they're in your potato patch because they eat all the leaves off your potato plants, and then your potatoes stop growing.
Mm-hmm.
And rot in the ground.
Yeah.
So what was Monsanto's response? Monsanto's response was to splice a gene from a goat into a potato plant. I guess it was a goat-tato. But they spliced a gene from a goat into a potato plant that was such that when the potato bug would bite the leaf, the goat gene would kill the potato bug.
Okay.
And Monsanto couldn't understand when people said, you know, I don't want to eat that potato.
Yeah.
And at one point, Lay's potato chips and McDonald's all had contracts with Monsanto to buy these Frankenspuds. But due to citizen action, citizen advocacy, activism, those contracts were at least canceled in theory.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, really, who wants to eat goat potatoes?
Right. I guess.
Technically, is that an Idaho russet or a Nubian milk?
Right. And you know, I guess the bees kind of eat some of these genetically modified plants, and seals tend to swim away from these, you know, hybrid salmon that are created in fish farms and have some patent on them. yeah, there's all kinds of, and, you know, there's whole allergy issues and, you know, resistance that the bugs will finally evolve to the to these Monsanto creations.
Well, sure they will. It's nature.
Yeah.
You know, it might take a while, but the potato bug will develop an anti-goat gene. And then we got to build a better goat, or maybe we get a gene from a platypus or something. That's the wrong way to do science.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll eventually mix a potato with a predator drone or something.
You know, why can't they do something useful like do a GM potato that has the gene from the cow that makes butter taste wonderful? Yeah, there you go, and splice that into a Yukon Gold, and, you know, you got dadgum, you got mashed potatoes right out of the ground. Don't even have to cook them anymore. Just dig them and wash them and eat them. Now, I'm being a smart aleck. It's all fascinating, but it's sort of academically fascinating because none of the, you know, Monsanto didn't have any studies saying, you know, well, no, okay, there's a terrible, terrible old joke out in the country. A car salesman or a traveling salesman is driving along and he sees a man out in the field, you know, with a goat. And he stops at the next house and the boy answers the door and he says, son, call the police. There's a man doing, you know, to a goat out in the field. And the little boy says, ah, don't worry about it. That's just dad. Monsanto didn't have any studies that suggested that, you know, that no one would wind up going, dad, time for dinner, from eating goat potatoes.
Right.
Because these are things that what they're fooling with is evolutionary biology, and that, you know, one of the variables in evolution. Wow, am I talking out of my hat now? Is the one of the variables is time. It's something times plus t for time equals dad. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, and News Ninja Gene is asking, wants to know if you know, Preston, is there a genetic standard for organic food that you've run across? I mean, is there a firm thou shalt not have any spliced genes organic kind of?
It depends on who you're buying your organics from. I think there are some companies that don't have a standard at all and are working, you know, in D.C. right now to let their definition of organic be the prevailing one, which may include genetically modified food. Other so-called organics might include radiated food. That's one of the big corporate agribusiness trends these days, radiation to treat your food. You sterilize it, you know. And but you just kind of have to dig around. There are good groups like the Organic Consumers Association that talk about that people are keeping the term organic real. And there are companies that, you know, would refuse GM food and things of that nature. So it depends on where you're shopping at or, you know. Just be careful who you buy from.
Yeah, it's almost like some sort of airport warning. You know, do not accept a bag from someone you do not know. Well, you know, don't accept a potato from someone you don't know either.
Right, right. There's certainly a lot of consciousness in you know, among consumers about, you know, keeping GMs, you know, not classified like that. So, yeah. Before I forget, I think last time I spoke, I was talking about some Nazi parallels and the Nazi spirit kind of living in our own society in some ways. And I mentioned people like Wernher von Braun, who was recruited by us to, you know, develop missiles. And there's another person, I think I misspoke and said Reinhold Niebuhr,
yes,
philosopher, and I meant to say Reinhard Gehlen, actually, who was an intel person for the Nazis who was recruited by the CIA.
Oh, to teach us how to do intel?
Yeah.
Oh, that's just so not nice.
Yeah, and it's always about the Russians. Got to stop the Russians. But again and again and again, you'll see it has very little to do with the Russians. In fact, Samuel Huntington, in a 1981 book, talked about how we need to present our interventions as a defense against the Russians. Otherwise, there won't be support for them. And the reality of our interventions had almost zero to do with the Russians and just had to do with, you know, empires taking advantage of defenseless countries, selling weapons. I think elites, military elites in both Russia and the U.S. kind of had a agreement of sorts, you know. They always kind of...
Yeah, honor among thieves.
Yep. And their military machine can make money off of bombing the hell out of Vietnam, you know, and arming people, and we could do the same. Same with Central America. You know, it's like two bullies in a bar, you know, threatening each other constantly and then deciding to go out on the sidewalk and beat up children and women they see on the street instead of fighting each other, you know.
What an analogy, and how very apt.
Yeah. But I'm going to dig up that Huntington quote, the clash of civilization. It's about, he was real popular. He had a big resurgence again. But it's the clash that, again, the war profiteers like, and the people that General Smedley Butler worked for, you know, they needed that clash.
Yeah, the guys running the racket?
Yep, that's right. But, I also wanted to comment on Joe Vecchio. He called you last week as well.
Yes.
And I was so glad that he brought up that, you know, kind of taboo subject about how we come across some of this stuff. And it's like, wow, how do you, like, not want to slit your wrists after you come across this demonic behavior? You know, you can kind of lose faith in humans. But keep in mind it is usually a small segment of humanity that's doing this kind of stuff. And
the price being paid by the large segment.
Yeah. And it may very well be a genocidal price. Actually, I'd like to read something, if I may.
Go right ahead.
And I think this kind of addresses that kind of despair that sometimes we feel about, you know, maybe this is going to be terminal. Maybe we have reached tipping points. But I don't believe that. I do believe that we're very resilient people, and there's so much resilient life forms out there that I think... there will be evolutions and adaptations, and life will continue. But for those who do, when you do run into those people who say there's no hope, this is kind of a response to that. And it's an article, a column called Handy Tips on How to Behave at the Death of the World. And it says, sometimes it comes in a dream, and sometimes in one more newspaper headline, and then you know. With yourselves and your past and future, you know, it's over. We are killing it all, and soon it will all be dead. We are here at the world, killers, witnesses, and those who will die. How then shall we live? Probably good to tell the truth as much as possible, truth generally appreciated by terminal patients, and we all are. Good to avoid shoddy activities. You are doing some of the last things done by beings on this planet. Generosity and beauty and basicness might be good ways to go. Avoid that which is self-serving in a small way. Keep in mind standing in for ancestors, including people who lived 10,000 years ago, and also fishes. Might be best to do activities that would make some ancestors feel honored to be part of bringing here. Silent statement to predecessors saying, well, yeah, we thing by killing ourselves. I tried to honor you as much as I could in that context by doing the following. And then there's a blank space for the reader to fill in for themselves. transform your own power over behavior to whatever extent possible. Life system of the world being efficiently killed by human habit of going for power over. Tasteful to try to profoundly correct that to extent that you can, even though it's too late. For example, men profoundly understand and change around relations with women. White people profoundly change in relations to people of color. Humans profoundly change in relationship to other beings on the planet. This constitutes a thank you note and note of apology to the whole history of the planet. I mean, it has been rather great. Sunsets, some art, some moments between beings, smells of fresh mornings. As we kill it all by dominance habits too huge to stop, we can thank it for the good times and say sorry by changing our own participation in the dominant stuff in some profound way. Doing this kind of change will involve confusion, embarrassment, and awareness of activities and attitudes you have not been conscious of. Doing this kind of change will involve increased aliveness for you personally, a fine thing to bring to a dying planet. Be in radical alignment with particular forms of aliveness being smashed. Particular species, human cultures, styles of living are being obliterated brutally. Inasmuch as we all are going to die fairly soon, the stylish thing to do is to align with one of those life forms and help it be itself as long and strong as possible. Eschew blandness, eschew causing others pain. We are all the target, so wear bright colors and dance with those you love. Falling in love has always been a bit too much to apply to one person. Falling in love is appropriate for now. To love all these things which are about to leave. The rocks are watching, and the squirrels, and the stars, and the tired people in the street. If you love them, let them know with grace and non-extravagance. Care about the beings you care about in gorgeous and surprising ways. Color outside the lines. Practice random kindness and senseless acts of beauty. This is your last chance.
You know, Preston, I love it when you find that stuff that just sounds like somebody wrote down the stuff that inhabits my dreams.
Great.
God,
great.
There is. Would you please send me a link to that?
Definitely. It's from the Whole Earth Review. Spring 1995. I don't think I have a computer link.
Oh, golly, there probably isn't.
Yeah, I mean, you probably knew Whole Earth Review. They published for about 2 decades.
Yeah.
But I've got photocopies. I've been photocopying this for years.
That's just magnificent. It is, because for me, I hear something like that, Preston, and it makes so eminently much sense. And yet, because of the twisted things that happen in my brain because of what's been done to me, yeah, I can just see some good-for-nothing right-winger going, oh, look at him, Trey Huggers.
Yeah.
But it's so real. You know, the people who like to go hunting, you know, before, and I've had people who were, you know, long-time and very good hunters say, you know, all the fun happens before you pull the trigger.
Yeah.
It's when you're in the duck blind before the flock arrives. It's when you're in the woods before you see the deer. It's moving with stillness and doing everything in your power not to break the spell.
Mm-hmm.
That makes it all worthwhile. You know, for love nor money, you could not get me out on a frozen lake to ice fish. Pulling the fish out of the water out on the frozen lake is not where the joy comes. It's in the camaraderie of a bunch of guys freezing their butts off around some sort of, you know, kerosene stove or some such,
mm-hmm.
and passing a bottle of brandy around, for heaven's sakes. Or hot coffee at 4 a.m. You know, it's moving around in the world when the world isn't moving around. And that thing, that piece right there is just absolute gold. That's I don't know if you put it in an envelope and send it to me. I promise you, Preston. It goes to a place of prominence where I can sit here while I'm behind the microphone and look at it.
I'll definitely send it along. In fact, I've been thinking about a little care package to send your way. There's a DVD I need to send you as well about the land struggles going on here in the Rocky Mountain West. You know, we've got a lot of gas in the ground, and they're, you know, Dick Cheney several years ago talked about the need, the alleged need for 38,000 miles of new pipeline. And a lot of that's going to be, already has been being built here in the Rocky Mountain West. The Roan Plateau, for example, was one beautiful wild area that our Governor Ritter went to, and he said something about having a religious experience. He was completely mocked, you know, by the usual right-wing people. And again, it's a policy that's being pushed through to put up these pipelines, and there's going to be all these sludge pits.
Yeah, and that stuff's no good for people in Colorado. No better for them than it is for us here. Sludge is, you know, maybe it's a language thing, Preston. Maybe we got to stop using the word sludge. Maybe we got to start using what it is. Maybe it's poison. You know, we had a huge, huge announcement here in West Virginia today. A citizens group, organizations with which I am affiliated from Coal River Mountain Watch, our friends at Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, the Sludge Safety Project, Concerted Citizens for Mingo County, released a citizen study today on coal sludge. And it's clear. And the groups had to do that because government wouldn't act. In the face of already knowing that there are people who are poisoned, honest to God, poisoned by this stuff, leaching into their groundwater, they wouldn't act. We're talking about toxicity levels where the federal government says that when it's that it's toxic in parts per billion, and some of this stuff, these toxins can be measured in parts per million or parts per thousand.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no better for y'all there than it is for us here. And maybe the trick is that we stop using euphemisms, and this is not a criticism of you, because I do it too. It's not a criticism of anyone. It's talking about language. You and I have talked so much about how we must get serious about language. Maybe we stop calling it sludge. Maybe we start calling it what it is.
That's true.
Poison.
Yep. And you know, and then you look at these moments. Actually, Udall. I don't know if he's a brother, he's a cousin, but there's a, okay, but I think his name's maybe Randy Udall, is prominent in this documentary about this, you know, destruction of the West going on, and it's, again, something that's wildly unpopular, and that there's this big industry push behind it that's making it happen. And you see the stuff, and in a way it is the world being killed in a way. But the beautiful part of it is how people, you know, despite their grief and their losses, and they're having to leave, you know, losing their hunting grounds or losing their ranches, they're gaining new relationships with people. And there's one scene in this film where this kind of right-wing hunting guide person, you know, 5 years ago, I would have never gotten into the same room with environmentalists, but now I have, and we've linked arms, and I have to say it's been a privilege to know these people and to work with them. So, and the battle's still on, you know, there's still some space left, and the end of the movie actually talks about a part of Montana where they successfully repelled the corporate tyranny, and you know, they got enough lawyers and enough citizens writing letters, speaking out, you know, overcoming their fears of, oh, gosh, I can't say something because my job, someone might say something or I might say something wrong, da, 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 da. They overcame it, and they just pressed on, and they won. So, you know, that's how they showed their love for these beings in their world. And
Well, when you do involve yourself with these efforts, Preston, you do meet magnificent people.
Yeah.
That's one of the beautiful things that happened for me and my family in the last few days in D.C.
Great.
To meet people who are involved in the same fight and have gone through so very much from Virginia, from Tennessee, from Kentucky, from other parts of West Virginia, and to participate in it, it is like a communion, because you are all dedicated to a common, honest, good-spirited, decent purpose, and you realize looking around that when people are this good working for this kind toward these goals, victory is almost preordained, so long as we are willing to see it through and continue the struggle and recognize that there is no classic American consumerist instant gratification involved. You know, you read that piece a minute ago, Preston, and I was reminded of my hero Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah.
Toward the end of his life, he said, "I have come to the conclusion that for the most part we were put here to dance."
Yes. Great.
And we were. And the other thing, though, is that inside these movements, it is also very exhausting. And I'm not talking about me. I'm talking about the people who've been living this for years and working this for years.
Yeah.
You know, my feet are sore from the last few days in D.C. But you know what? I kept thinking, you know what? My feet hurt like hell. But that's my fault for bad shoes. And I can take a little of this, considering what everybody else has taken a whole bunch more of. But it is so transforming. It really makes you a different person from who you were when you first got there.
Yeah, and we'll be disappointed, and we'll disappoint ourselves or be disappointed by others, and you know, all kinds of setbacks, and you know.
Oh sure, I was looking at lists of representatives and congresspeople, and this is my own cynicism, but you know, there were people whose names I would see, and you know, they're not even worth my time. And that was, and then there's still a pretty healthy little idealist who hides cowering under the hard candy shell of cynicism that I maintain, Preston. And it hurt me.
Yeah.
Because you know what? I should be able to walk into someone's office and get a fair hearing.
Mm-hmm.
It should not be a foreordained conclusion. You know, I walked into offices where it was a foreordained conclusion. I walked into the office of John D. Rockefeller IV, who, for reasons I don't understand, thinks more of coal companies than he does of actual living, breathing West Virginians.
Yep.
And you know, not to just keep beating on something, you know, when my daughter asked him if someone was threatening his grandchildren, would he fight for them? Then I hope you understand why I'm here fighting for my niece and nephew. And I won't stop.
Great.
And it was like a thunderclap. Because you know what? Corporate America has sons and daughters too. But corporate America has the means of keeping their sons and daughters away from what corporate America does.
Yeah.
You know, they aren't blowing up mountains in Pocahontas County, West Virginia, where Jay Rockefeller has his cabin.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I guess they've also just absorbed this philosophy. Every once in a while, I'll hear it from Limbaugh or kind of a local person who's kind of has this, que sera, sera, you know, this is progress, this is inevitable. You know, this debate, it's in the Bible, it's in the Torah, it's the discussion between the Pharaoh and the people trying to free themselves from the Pharaoh.
Yes.
You know, those, and you know, so it continues.
And yet it's the, you know, the right wing are constantly harping on communism and socialism. And yet it's the right wing and corporate America, Preston,
that is telling me and mine and us here in Appalachia and people in Western states who are being assaulted by corporate poisoners. It's the right wing telling us that we have to sacrifice for the collective. Now you tell me who the commie is.
Right, right. You know, not only do we have this gas drilling going on, oil shale is also, oil companies have been buying up all these water rights, millions of cubic feet of water rights, both stored water and water they intend to divert to help in their process of getting shale, oil from shale. They ranted and raved over how inefficient, corn is as a fuel. And again, there's truth to that. But there are other options. You know, there's algae experiments going on. There's other sorts of grasses that could very well have some appropriate uses in certain contexts, you know, depending on availability and, you know what ecosystem you're living in. But they want to dismiss it altogether because it's so inefficient. But tar sands and oil shale, which is hugely inefficient, and again, creates all these poisons, they're plowing ahead with that, full steam ahead.
And as a result of what we did at PowerShift a couple of weeks ago, Preston, I got a call a few days last night during the show, as a matter of fact, and I have to return the call. I'm going to start trying to learn climb the learning curve on the tar sands. I know enough to know how awful it is. So I've got to get involved with that and at least make that issue a little bit bigger, a little bit louder, because we can't do what we are demand, what the right wing and corporatists demand. Recognize national boundaries when it comes to the humanity, to our brotherhood and sisterhood with other peoples on the planets.
Yeah.
The tar sands are big. It's a big Canadian issue. You know what? For them, where the tar sands are concerned, I'm Canadian.
Yep. And for people who don't know, developing those tar sands in Canada, they're looking at taking down a forested area the size of Florida in Canada. And already,
yeah, because we can do without the trees.
Mm-hmm. And already birds that migrate, you know, from South America through North America, through the U.S. up into Canada are landing in these toxic ponds that are created and, you know, dying. They're estimating millions upon millions of birds will be lost. So, you know, the numbers of us, again, from anti-mining activists, indigenous activists, consumer activists, you know, health people, you know, concerned about the air and water we're drinking, to, you know, the Audubon Society and all the teachers. I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah, and you remind me of something. We're in here where we are. We're in the flight path of goose migration.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody ever seen any flocks of geese settle on a poison sea?
It's heartbreaking.
I don't think so. You know, the geese know better. Those prairie dogs know a human with a gun in his hands. Geese know the difference between poison and water that's safe to land on.
Oh, they've been avoiding it because I know some birds get confused by it.
Well, I don't know. I'm guessing. I think it would be worth it to make an inquiry. One of the problems, though, is that the coal companies make sure that you can't get close enough to do any kind of observation. Now, if those sludge seas are safe, then why can't you get close to them?
Right. Well, that's.
But you know, we need. You know, that's where we need. You know, one of the great hunting conservation organizations is Ducks Unlimited. That's where we need Ducks Unlimited. We need to find out, you know, what happens to waterfowl when and if they land on these things.
And isn't there Pheasants Forever, I think, is another one.
I think so, yeah. Well, Preston, I have to roll on. It's been a great conversation, and I'm glad we got to have it.
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad the line worked out okay, and I'm glad we got to chat. And we'll talk again soon for sure.
All right, take care, Preston.
You too, Bob.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Preston calling from Colorado. I so admire his activism. So it's about 6 minutes before the hour. We've added an hour to the program. I hope you didn't mind. Remember, everything after the third hour is free. And if a baseball goes into the stands, it's yours to keep. Okay, I'm being a smart aleck. Wonderful, wonderful evening with you all this evening. Thank you very much. And thank you for pushing us here on the 19th day of March. Thank you for getting us at least over the $1,000 mark for the month of March. It would be awfully nice to actually reach our goal for a change. But thank you for those of you who can. And you know what? Thank you for those of you who wish you could contribute financially. I know what it means to want to do things that you can't. And know that you are appreciated however it is you participate in the programming. Your emails are always welcome. You're welcome in the chat room. We'd love to have you on the forum. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/forum. We love having you along however it is you choose to be with us. So thank you. Thank you to Peter Godbold, our IT professional. Thank you to John Fox, who is working his way into the new digs and digging it, I understand. Thank you to Ben Birch, the hardest working man in liberal talk. That is not a joke. That is not hyperbole. That is reality. For a whole bunch of people, for a whole bunch of programs, if you hear it, you hear it because Ben Birch took it upon himself to make sure you could. He never sends a bill. But at WhiteRoseSociety.org, he too needs all the help that he can get. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, coalriverwind.org. Standing upstream, fighting, never giving up, because they know we're all downstream. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.